WKOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. I'll be back in just a few minutes. Good evening, everybody. Hello there. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Wonderful stuff there to start the show off. That's called Prayer from Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. Before we get to that, though, let's do our duties here and say thanks to Debbie. Debbie Johnson, as always, Free Range Radio Theater. 1 hour before this program, 10 p.m. every Monday night. Debbie does wonderful radio theater on the air here at KOPN. Great stuff tonight, as always, doing the wonderful Cyrano de Bergerac. Kelvin and Jason before that doing it up, jazz plus blues equals earth bloom. Tech Radio, incredible stuff on Tech Radio. I always love that. They always have interesting information about this amazing high technology and the fast-moving world, I guess, of high tech. But tonight, great stuff with Justin and John. And, of course, Jeff Wheeler starts things off 3 p.m. to 5 every Monday. Good radio, good music, good talk, good news on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you and a part of it all. All right, thanks to everybody who participated and listened to the program last week. A big thank you to Gary David. Interesting research regarding the ancient indigenous peoples of the American Southwest, the Hopi, the Anasazi, and their relationship with the stars and constellations up there above our heads. Thanks a lot to Gary for being on the program and for the work he's doing. Also to the Starlings, wonderful music from Seattle, Washington. If you missed the show, it's all on the web at www.mikehagan.com. And just click on over there to the program archives, okay? All right, tonight, Neil Adams. He's an artist, a comic book writer, a guy who's also, though, turning certain scientific theories on their heads, and he's a pretty interesting person with a lot of different talents and ideas. But tonight we'll be talking with him primarily about his notion of a growing Earth. We'll be talking about conventional theories of plate tectonics and Pangea and moving land masses and geothermic activities, subduction, all this sort of stuff. And then we'll hear some of the more unconventional ideas from Neil that are challenging long-held, you know, dogmas and beliefs in geology and planetary science, for sure. So we'll talk with Neil Adams in a little bit here. What, I don't know, 50 minutes or so, top of the hour at midnight. And if you want to get a leg up, hop on the web, go to mikehagan.com. You'll see information about Neil right there on the front page. You can click over to his website at neiladams.com. And also tonight, we will have the music of my good friends, Lizzie West and Baba the White Buffalo. And I have in my notes here, hopefully they'll be here to see us shortly. But actually, they already have arrived. And I better put on their mics just in case Lizzie decides she wants to say something, because you never know with her.
Well, hallelujah to you.
Hello there. How are you, Lizzie West?
Oh, we're so good. I'm feeling great tonight.
Yeah, I'm feeling great tonight, too.
All right. Well, I'm glad to have you here with me. We started the show off, I should say, with a song that's called Prayer, Lizzie, and it's the first time I heard it actually today. I was trying to snoop up some new music to play to start the show off, and it's just a beautiful tune, and we're going to hear more from Lizzie and Tony. But before we hear another song, Lizzie, when did you write that, first of all?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I didn't write those lyrics. That's an old, well, actually, it's anonymous, technically. I believe it's an
that guy wrote
a Native American Indian.
That girl wrote a lot of stuff, that anonymous person.
Yeah. So I believe it's a Native American Indian poem or prayer. Mm-hmm. But I wrote the music to that when I was about 16, and I was horseback riding out in the woods, and I used to go visit this grave that I found with a plaque on it that had those words on it, and I started singing it to myself, that melody. And I used to sing in the woods so that I wouldn't get shot. It's like, you know, in hunting season.
Yeah, and yeah. Wear orange and sing.
Right. And I just think that's really interesting because I basically continue to sing so I don't get shot. That's really a powerful, powerful method of not getting shot by social structure, all kinds of things that will shoot your spirit down daily.
That's right. You know, Crazy Horse, they said that they couldn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because when he got on his horse and when he went into battle, he literally he became a spirit, and the bullets would go either right around him or right through him. Nobody could ever really understand what happened, but he sang.
When he was out at
war.
Oh,
yeah, you know. And
it's a good day to fight, and it's a good day to die.
It's a good day to die. Actually, there's no good days for either of those things, in my opinion, right now. But if you got it, you got it, you know.
I think the general message is just willing to grow for what we believe in.
That's
willing
right.
To really be passionate and truly, truly grow for it.
And not be afraid.
Not be afraid to grow.
And not be afraid. And not be afraid to die.
No.
You know, I have no intention
of dying.
Death.
You know? There is no death.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is the part of it, this is what comes through in that song.
That's right, yeah. And many stories about that to come, too. There's no death.
All right. Okay, well, look, let me say a couple more things here about what we're going to do tonight, and then we'll come back, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's Lizzie and Baba Buffalo. We'll talk with Neil Adams, as I said, in just a little while here. We'll have the music of Lizzie and Baba. Like I said, we started things off with a song called Prayer, and I think we'll play another one right now, actually in a minute or so, and then we'll have some live music from Lizzie and Baba, and then we'll get on with things as we always do, okay? But I wanted to say something really quickly, by the way. I actually spent a little time over at the Holy Roadhouse, and I'm going to turn your mics back on, you guys, yesterday, and I want to make sure that people know what a cool thing you guys did and what you're doing over there. It was a thing that was called, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Tumbleweed Children's Hour.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my son, Alistair, and I went over to the Holy Roadhouse over there on St. Joe Street, and there were a bunch of other kids and parents and entertainers of all sorts that were...
Bones.
Yeah, Bones mm-hmm. was there, and we had a wonderful time. My son had a great time, and I just wanted to thank you for it, and maybe you can tell people a little bit about it.
Go ahead.
Well, we're in the process of developing a couple things now. A cabaret, which is more of an adult version, and also a children's version called Tumbleweed Time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of different characters that we've been developing and changing into and with songs and stories.
What's
and
one
costumes.
Of the characters you play, Bob?
I play a meatball. Marvin the Meatball.
Yes.
You also play a wonderful doctor.
I play a doctor,
right.
Dr. Tumbleweed, and Dr. Tumbleweed's Remembering Tonic, curing fear since 1869.
Yeah, it's really fun being with the kids. I mean, their imagination, there is no limit.
Yeah, and they're right there following the whole story.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, it was obvious to me. They were, what were there, 10 or 12 kids there at least.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
All very well-behaved and really enjoying themselves. And you could see the looks in their eyes, how much they were enjoying themselves. And there's music and dance and all kinds of stuff. We played with parachutes and learned how to juggle and played the bones and you name it. But it was a great time and you guys did a great
party.
Time.
Party. It's a creating peace party.
Yeah, it was great. So, and what's the plans for the future of this type of thing?
Well, actually, that was really our first official one that we did, I think, with the kids. And we're planning to continue workshopping it on the East Coast, and then we will release a children's album and tour that along with our adult Tumbleweed Cabaret, which actually the Tumbleweed Cabaret is happening this Saturday at Mojo's, so
what's that,
should mention that.
16th?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
Okay.
And that is also for children who love to sing, dance, and play.
Of all ages.
Children of all ages.
Yeah.
And that's a good time, man. We sing, don't we?
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
Toasting the tonic.
Uh-huh. Never too late to have a happy childhood.
That's for sure. That's
right.
For sure. All right, well, look, let's take a little bit of a break. I'm going to play another song. We'll come back, and we'll talk a little bit more, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. That's Lizzie West and Baba Buffalo. Lizzie West and the White Buffalo sitting here in the studio with me, talking a little bit about Tumbleweed Children's Hour. I thank them for that. It was cool. If you want information about this, of course, on the web, everything they do is available at LizzieWestLife.com, L-I-Z-Z-I-E, West Life, LizzieWestLife.com. And you can link there, of course, from my site and have been able to for quite some time. Info, of course, about all the musicians that I feature on the program here can be found on the web at my site. Just go over to Mike Hagan and click on the Music Archives. Okay? All right, so good stuff on the way. Stick with me if you can, if you care, if you dare. And once again, Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. This is a song called Dusty Turnaround. We'll come back and we'll do space weather, some news, talk a little bit with Neil Adams at the top of the hour. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit one more time. This is Lizzie and Baba. The song is called Dusty Turnaround.
Man, there ain't no place like home. goes to the one-eyed butler across the street. Fix me something fast, for they are hungry and they must eat. He gives her the makings of a very fine meal. She throws them at his feet. Don't you tell me how I feel. He takes two to think of how the story goes. But by the time he warns her folks, she's a halfway down the road. He takes that dusty turnaround, yellow brick road. Just remember, man, there is no place like home. For her, he would kill. He keeps his hands in her curls. They want to change the world. Then he thinks that she might be crazy like the ones he had before. He bolts and he locks the cabin door. Crazy man, I tell you what, she might be wise. She lives to break the jealous man's lies. She travels far and travels wide. She travels far and travels wide. Oh, how I sing. You take that dusty turnaround.
That's right, there's no place like home. And this is home right here, Columbia, Missouri, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 20 minutes after 11 p.m. on the 11th of June, 2007. Rolling right along here as we do. And let me say hello really quickly to everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN, live or otherwise. If you listen over the traditional airwaves or over the web, we say hello to all of you, and every Monday we broadcast this radio program from the wonderful studios here in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri, KOPN, and we stream the show on the internet as well. Just go over there to kopn.org and click on the Listen Live button, and you'll get a lovely 64K stream that'll bring the music and the talk to you every Monday night and every minute of the day if we're doing things right. Okay, thanks to everyone, by the way, that makes it happen, live and on the radio, and on the net, I should say. Thanks to everyone who helps us out, and we appreciate it. As well, I'd like to thank all the people out there sending art, music, poetry, wonderful stuff in the Poets Corner, and some great new music to share with you over the next few weeks. And if you're interested and got the gumption, send me the stuff. And I'll find a place for it on the website. And if it's music, I'll listen to it. And if you got 10 or 11 songs that I can choose from and, you know, that I like, I'll be glad to share it with other people and maybe feature your music on the show one of these nights. Okay. Okay. We have a forum up at the website. Just go over there and click on the Orbit forum, and there's lots of people always in there, busy talking about interesting topics and discussing, debating, whatnot. More than I can keep up with these days. And there's also a live chat that is up and active every Monday night, including tonight. Again, just go to the website and click on the live chat link and take you over there, and you can join in with all the people that are listening to the program on the web and talking about it as we talk with them. All right? I encourage my guests as well as my listeners to join us in the chat room and the forum. If you want to get a hold of me, Orbit Radio, ORBITRADIO at AOL.com. Send email to my guests. Send email to the musicians that we have on the program. Right, Lizzie? Don't you like to hear from people?
It keeps us going. Keeps us growing.
Huh, Bob?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, me too. So we love it when we get stuff. And,
so much.
Yeah, I take the good and the bad and the ugly and whatever you got to say. I love it all. In fact, sometimes the most entertaining stuff that I get is stuff that's just, as rude as you can imagine.
Really?
I'm sure. I don't know if you guys get that sort of stuff. You ever get, you guys get a lot of nice mail, I imagine. You ever get hate mail?
I don't think I've ever really gotten hate mail. I got an email from someone who was very angry because she had bought her CD and it didn't work.
Oh, wow.
But seeing that I'm not the record label, I didn't really know how to help her. Anyway, that's...
Well... Let me tell you, I get some doozies.
Do you really? Oh, well, because you're talking about important things.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I think it is interesting though to see what people have to say. But at any rate, it's great to be able to talk about whatever we like and whatever anybody says. We're as free as we like to be these days, and I sure act like I am, and I know you guys do too. And that's why we're here talking together tonight. So, Lizzie West, what else is happening in your world?
Wow, we are working so hard, really taking our vision for Holy Road Tours and making it a national vision. It's a large vision, super exciting. Mike Robertson moved into the house and is now house manager at the Holy Road House.
Mike of C3 and other projects around this area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we are just now beginning to compile our first edition of the Holy Now Journal, which is exciting because that's going to be a monthly journal online that will feature all kinds of folks, including yourself and other great people who are doing important things.
Yeah, artists, writers.
Time. Yep. The folks we find on the road and want to share with not only our fan base, but all kinds of viewers. So that's exciting. We're also developing a new campaign for next year, which we won't talk too much about, but just say that it is truly adventurous.
Yeah, all right. Mm-hmm. What do you got planned for the summer?
Preparing for that campaign, actually.
Yeah, basically preparing, going, traveling back east, and I think California for a little bit, too, and doing a residency in upstate New York, Hudson Valley.
The Hammertown House.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay, somebody's calling on the phone. You want to take a phone call?
Sure.
See what they got to say. Radio Orbit, hello, who's this?
Yes, this is Marilyn Adams, Neil's wife.
Oh, I'm Marilyn.
Isn't he supposed to be interviewed?
Yeah, but Marilyn, actually, hold on a second, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks.
Okay.
Hang on, everybody. I'm going to just take a little break, and I'm going to have Lizzie West and Baba Buffalo play a little song for us, if you don't mind, because I got a little phone call here I got to take care of. All right? So I'm going to ask you guys to play something for us. And I'm going to grab the telephone here with Marilyn, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more, okay? Everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. This is Lizzie West, Baba Buffalo, the White Buffalo. Lizzie West playing a song for y'all. Back in just a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN.
But in my way, I'd like to stay
until I know I've won, I have won. Until I know I've won. Cause I can take that midnight train to another time. No, I'm stuck here and it's getting late, and I'm waiting for a sign. A sign, yeah, I'm waiting for a sign. I was told of gold. I traveled 15 miles to find it so. And then 10 more to the man who made the gold's front door. He let me in to tell his sins. And left my pockets empty as they were before. In the end I will dig sin, like all the rest have done. But in my way I'd like to stay until I know I've won. I have won until I know I've won. They join the choir to make their noise. They're lifting off of the ground. 80-90 doctors will make their rounds. They let me in to count my sins. Not a one can tell me what it is.
It's funny, I was at the, I go down to the Blue Fugue a lot before I come down here and do the show, and I told a few of my friends down there, there's open mic down there every Monday night, and for people listening, it's wonderful if you're a musician locally around town here, and you want a chance to see what other people are doing and see a whole bunch of different stuff and get a chance to sort of...
We heard it. It's totally happening.
Oh,
theme. Yeah.
Great stuff down there, and you never know what you're going to get, and of course, as always, some... Perhaps you like you might like better than others, but everything from comedy routines, people up there doing stand-up comedy, and lots of great stuff. But anyway, tonight was no different, but there were some great bands that were playing tonight, and some of my friends were sort of tossed whether they would come and go, but I wouldn't be surprised if people are walking in the door here any minute to come and say hi to you guys. But they're running out of time, so. Anyway, wonderful song. What's the name of that one, Lizzie?
It's called Waiting for a Sign.
Waiting for a Sign, okay.
Yeah.
Is that on I Pledge Allegiance to Myself?
No, that's going to come out on a new album.
All right. Well, I want to mention your most recent album called I Pledge Allegiance to Myself.
Mm-hmm.
Been out now for what?
A year and a half.
April of 2006.
Yeah, so I guess it's a year and a half.
It's been around a year or so.
Yeah, and it's done really well for itself thanks to some great perseverance from Baba over here because he sent it to Democracy Now. And they've been incredibly supportive and have been playing it a bunch.
Yeah.
Great.
I know three or four times probably, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a big deal for people who aren't familiar with that show. Amy Goodman does a news a radio and television program every morning, and it's broadcast on all kinds of different stations,
it's a great television show.
And she does a great job of bringing lots of news that people aren't aware of to people. But she also is a fan of music, obviously, and 19 Miles to Baghdad has gotten quite a bit of exposure through that program. Good for you. Have you had any personal communication with the people that run the show there?
No, not yet. We're in the process of putting together a thank you gift for them.
Yeah, we have a 19 Miles page where you can actually download it for free at our website.
And we ask you to then donate.
Yeah, and then it links to their site. You can donate to Democracy Now, and there's a couple other songs you can get for free at our site too there. So.
And again, that's LizzieWestLife.com.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. Yeah, and you can link there from my site as well. Let's see. I want to talk about the residency program and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys going to be here in Columbia over the summer? And who's going to be at the house? What's going on?
No, we have our residency on the East Coast in August, so we're heading back there. And we're working on booking the rest of the year artists in residency for month-long to three-month-long residencies. Actually, there will be weekend residencies, too. So it's exciting, and it's all very much a work in progress. But at this stage, we're just thinking about which artists and who's free to do it, to come and really be here in the community for anywhere from a weekend to 3 months to longer. So it's really exciting. I think it's an important way to tour, to get to know community, to be able to have time to write and live in a holistic fashion. We'll be back here for our Midwest residency in October for that month.
And but you'll be here until August.
We will not. No, we will be leaving at the end of June to head.
Mm-hmm.
He has
a residency
in July, and then we have one together in August.
All right. All right. What's happening on the East Coast? You're just back from there recently, actually, right?
Well, we're back from the route. I mean, because we have this route that we're traveling from here to New York and then up to Madison, Wisconsin, through Chicago and back again.
We also have some people in Louisville that we're working with, and we stayed there for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really great scene bubbling there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had some of those people come, and we're going to have them come back as well.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the idea for those people who don't know about Holy Road Tours, it's a startup nonprofit that's dedicated to creating an alternative way of touring and for artists, a holistic way of touring and traveling, because so many of our messengers are lost to drug addiction and suicide, and we're just disappearing into the hills. And we're dedicated to.
I might do that one of these days.
No, you won't.
I'm
we
already
need
in the hills.
Too much.
Shy.
Hell, man, we need you. We need each other. We all need each other. And in these times, it's really important that artists are delivering messages of song and timelessness.
Well, it's the big time right now for art in general. And there are two things that come to mind. I had one of my old friends who I quote often. And I don't even have to invoke his name anymore. People know who I'm talking about. But he used to say that what was required, and he said this 10 years ago, but he was so far ahead of his time, he said was, you know, an immense explosion of art and creativity and imagination and just to slam the art pedal through the floorboard, you know.
That's right, yeah.
And I think that's what...
The only way to really do that is for everybody to recognize and understand and believe in the very core of their being that they are an artist, and every single person is an artist. and has something to say and something to give and something to sing, and just the very essence of being alive is an art form. And if we could all comprehend our majesty, I mean, within us, that can come out of us if we give it the time and the attention it deserves.
And love.
Yeah, we would just be evolving at such an incredible rate.
Well, you know, some of us are.
But
and
we
I don't
all
necessarily
need
include myself. But some people are. I mean, this is the one thing that, this is the, you know, and I don't know if we wanted to talk about this stuff, but this is the non-sentimentality of nature. You know, is it evolution? Not everybody makes it. This is unfortunate, you know, for the, you know, for those individuals of any particular species that don't have the right genetic makeup or the right luck or the right intelligence or whatever. But same thing goes for us, frankly, you know. And I think that this word that's been on my mind so much lately is the word bifurcation. And it basically means when in this context, in an evolutionary context, it means a splitting apart of a species where, for example, you know, when Homo erectus split off into this and that and the other thing or whatever. But we have these times when the particular most dominant expression of the genetic makeup splits, and it literally does become two different species. And then, you know, well, one of them tends to mitigate out the other one, usually. So
well,
this is what's going on. I mean, honestly, I mean, who knows how it's all going to pan out, but something is happening. You see more and more polarity, I think, and lots of people turning on to certain things,
right.
And lots of people really turning off.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's exciting and beautiful and gracious about the human spirit and the human condition is our innate desire to share with each other and to shine the light on each other and to help each other evolve. We have this really wonderful desire to share it. And I'm hoping that that's going to win out, you know, that we can really all help each other evolve.
Yeah. I always say, you know, may the best story win.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's all about stories and the stories we tell. And
the myth. The myth.
And that's right. And what's happening in large part, and what I try to do on this program, what you guys are a part of, is telling new stories, first of all, but also revivifying old stories. Again, the stories of the ancestors, because, man, those were good stories, and they've been lost and forgotten, but they weren't fully lost and forgotten, and they're still there, and it's just, you know, it's our job to share those stories with other people. And, man, they are revivifying in and of themselves, just telling them, you know?
Yeah, and just not to get stuck, you know? It's just not get stuck.
Yeah. And when you do, get unstuck.
Right.
You know?
And if you're not
stuck,
help somebody else
get unstuck. That's right. All right, let's see. How about another little piece of music for us? Would you do that?
Sure.
All right, everybody. Lizzie West, Baba Buffalo. This one is called something I don't know.
The absent-minded doodler left the door wide open when she left to go and walk her God. She didn't notice her pocket, the zipper was broken, so she just kept walking. When something fell to the ground,
now some might say she's been smoking,
but really she was just dreaming, whistling at the sky with her gun by her side. The absent-minded doodler left the door wide open when she left to go and walk her God. She didn't notice her pocket, the zipper was broken, so she just kept walking when something fell to the ground.
Now some might say she's been smoking,
but really she was just dreaming, whistling out the sky with her God by her side. Find out what happened to the doodler. What fell out of her pocket? Come to the cabaret Saturday night. The cabaret of dreams. Tumbleweed Cabaret.
Alright. Lizzie West and Baba Buffalo. Find information about these lovely musicians on the web at www.lizziewestlife.com. And they got the MySpace thing and all that, so just go out there and find them. Use your ingenuity and your web skills, okay? All right, let's see. We've got a couple more minutes here. Let's wrap something up really quickly here.
What about the big canoe? Share that with folks.
Yeah, talk about that, because I want to play that, actually. I want to play that before or on the way out, at least. So talk about that for a minute. Let me grab that, actually. Go ahead and talk a little bit about it, though.
All right. Well, Baba, you want to say something?
Yeah, we recorded The River, the Big Canoe, which was written by the late, great Bob Dyer, who is a singer-songwriter historian that lived in
Boonville.
Local
here, yeah.
Mm-hmm. About 20 minutes outside of Columbia. And we recorded it with a group that we've been forming at the Holy Roadhouse called The Hucksters, part of the co-op, and...
Yeah, we're forming a co-op cover band, and anybody out there, you know, we keep saying this, but we're really an open-door policy over there. We need help, and we all need help helping mm-hmm. each other live better lives, and that's what Holy Road Tours is all about. So
yes, come on by.
Come on by mm-hmm. and investigate, and we'll investigate together,
mm-hmm.
researching yeah. how things seem to work
yeah,
out.
Yeah, and I mean... The Roadhouse is a wonderful place, and they're always friendly and
right.
Well, and you never know who you run into over there, which is always cool.
That's true. There's a community garden that just went next door too, which was really
perfect
nice.
Place for
yeah.
it. And yeah, is that what went into that
yeah.
lot there? Well, that's cool because there was sort of a nice empty space there, and
yeah.
So the best way to do it is just to go to our website. You can write us. We get all those emails. We read them all, and then let us know, and we'll have you come over and show you the place. And I brought it up because we have a band that's a co-op cover band called The Hucksters.
And we recorded The River, the Big Canoe, which we're selling, I guess, at...
To raise money.
To raise money for two local nonprofits, MoRiv CC, the Missouri
mm-hmm.
River
mm-hmm.
Cultural Conservancy.
Right.
And The Big Canoe, which was an urban...
Urban farming, urban agriculture, mm-hmm. consciousness about all good things. So
but you can get that at MySpace, Holy Roadhouse 1.
Mm-hmm. Or also at the Journal, which will be coming out mm-hmm. next week. So.
Okay. All right, so a big show coming up on the 16th, that's Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys are going to be boogieing for a little while.
Yeah, we'll be leaving. But before we leave, we are going down to do the Peace Conspiracy
right. And
Festival.
Maybe if we're lucky, we might see you out in Roachport on the
mm-hmm.
23rd, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, if we're back.
Yeah, if you're back. I mean, even any time late, midday, late day, Sundays, Monday, any time in the middle of the night, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're always welcome. So, mm-hmm. All right, you guys, so let's play The Big Canoe, all right? I'll play that and say goodbye to you guys off the air. And thank you so much for all the work you're doing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the work you're doing.
Care
of our spirits and hearts.
Yeah.
We love you.
Yeah, we love you too. You guys are rocking and rolling. Okay, so this is The Big Canoe. Again, a tribute to Bob Dyer, right?
It is Bob Dyer's song, and it's our co-op cover band. I'm just singing backup. So Bart Bean and Baba are doing lead vocals with a bunch of other folks.
All right, sounds good, everybody. It's been Lizzie and Baba. Thank you so much. One more time.
And the Dharma.
Don't forget him. He's down here sleeping so kindly and not making any noise or anything. Didn't attack my ankles like the chiggers and ticks have been. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I love you guys. We'll talk to you soon, okay? All right, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the way out here, back in just a few minutes with Neil Adams. Check this out from Ah, yes, the Hucksters. And here it is, the big canoe.
1, 2, 3.
Mountains and the melting snow, see her in the falling rain, see her dancing down through a thousand valleys, the sky at least a thousand names. She's the spawn of the ice of another age, the river of the big canoe, and she's rolling on down from the Rocky Mountains, carrying the Yellowstone and the mussel shell, the milk and a little mold. The James, the Grand, and the White and the Bad, the Cheyenne and the White Monroe. She's the spawn of the ice of another age, the river of the big canoe. And she's rolling on down from the Rocky Mountains, carrying the train. Frenchmen found her, she would peck a canoe, muddy river wild and free. Gave her the name of the Indians who lived there, the people called it Misery. She's the spawn of the ice of another age, the river of the big canoe. And she's rolling on down from the Rocky Mountains, burying the painter's mind, the music in the poet's song. She's the spawn of the ice of another age, the river of the big canoe. And she's rolling on down from the Rocky Mountains, carrying the great train, carrying the great train through. She's the spawn of the ice of another age, the river of the big canoe.
The Hucksters, that's Big Canoe. Thanks very much to Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. Lizzie and Baba, thanks. I'll talk to you guys very soon, and I'll see you on Thursday. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And got, what, I don't know, about 9 minutes or so before the top of the hour. Neil Adams is going to be with us in just a few minutes. Looking very forward to our talk with Neil tonight. And before that, let me just mention a couple of quick things here about what's coming up over the next few weeks. Neil Adams, of course, tonight in just a few minutes. Next week, Peter Light will talk about permaculture. My friend Lance introduced me to Peter, I should say. Wonderful guy with amazing information on how we might manage our own communities a little bit better. We'll talk about that next week with Peter Light. The 25th, I think I'll probably do something myself. We've got an open date. Unless something drops in there, I'll probably just spend some time with you all myself. On the 2nd of July, Richard Allen Miller, backed by popular demand. Patrick Flanagan coming up sometime soon. Dr. Richard Tarnas, of course, the author of Cosmos and Psyche. And you know, although I've read much of that, Passion of the Western Mind was one that I really thought was a wonderful book that that Dr. Tarnas wrote. But at any rate, Dr. Richard Tarnas, sometime in the next couple of months, we just got to sort of nail down the date. John Major Jenkins, spoke with John just a few days ago. John and I get something going later this summer. Dennis McKenna, of course. Dr. Dennis in Peru right now. And wonderful stuff coming from Dennis, as always. We'll have him back at the end of the summer, okay? Lots going on, as always. Wonderful music coming to you as well. Some announcements that I wanted to make really quickly. Emmanuel Velikovsky, June 10th, 1895. Emmanuel Velikovsky was born. And he was one of my, and is one of my sort of heroes. Talk about a guy who had sort of alternative ideas about how the Earth was formed and came to be the way it is. Emmanuel Velikovsky, certainly a pioneer in sort of fringe ideas of evolution and geology and lots of other things. So sort of jives with our program tonight. But at any rate, Emmanuel Velikovsky, if you're not familiar with his work, there's lots of ways to find out about it, and the Internet probably the best among them. So check out Emmanuel Velikovsky. He was born on June 10th in 1895. And on the same day, June 10th in 1955, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin moved along to the next life. Another very interesting man who had some interesting ideas about the future. And we've talked about Chardin quite a bit on the program. In fact, when you know, when Jose Arguelles was on the program earlier in the year, Chardin came up. And we've talked about him a number of other times, but again, an interesting fellow, a Jesuit, believe it or not, someone who is worth remembering and noting. Died 1955, June 10th. Okay, so here's to both of them, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and Emmanuel Velikovsky. Okay. Also, from my friend Danny, there is a memorial walk for Leonard Peltier on the 26th of June. That's coming up in about 2 weeks or so, but there's a quick letter that I'll read here from Rosalind Jumping Bull, and again, this is in South Dakota, Oglala, South Dakota, June 26th, the memorial walk for Leonard Peltier. Dear friends, we are planning the annual June 26th walk for Leonard Peltier. We're in need of your assistance. We'll need help in purchasing food, gas. The gathering begins with a memorial walk to the residence. The original road is overgrown and in disrepair. A grove of trees marks where the house once stood. This memorial walk ends under the grove of trees. Rosalind will provide food, refreshments, and a place for participants to sit down. And then the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee will begin their portion of the memorial. If you're interested in this and you have a chance to be up there in South Dakota, it's a worthy cause. And one of these days we're going to get Leonard Peltier out of jail. And I hope it's soon. At any rate, Rosalind Jumping Bull can be contacted in Oglala, South Dakota, 57764, and if you're interested in this, just get a hold of me, okay? All right, space weather, new moon, very soon, sun getting quiet, Atlantis and Isis up there, you can see them if you're looking for them, lots of other stuff, the usual comets and asteroids passing by us. I won't go into too much detail because we've got Neil Adams in just a few minutes, so I will play one more piece of music and get my act together here, and we will come back with the wonderful Neil Adams. Very excited about it at the top of the hour in just a few minutes, okay? If you want to get a leg up, as I said, hop on the web at MikeHagan.com or go over to NeilAdams.com. You can link over either way and take a look at what Neil's up to in the science section of his website primarily, but we'll certainly talk about a little of his background and some of the other things that he's been involved in and is still doing these days. He's got a lot of interesting projects, and we'll talk a little bit about all of it with Neil in just a few minutes, okay? In the meantime, one more from my good friend Lizzie West. This is a song that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, one that's been featured on Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now!, a number of times over the last few months. It's a great tune. It's called 19 Miles to Baghdad. It's from her CD called I Pledge Allegiance to Myself. I'm all with you, Lizzie. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. Back in just a minute with Neil Adams.
Got snow in April. soldier, load up your guns and tie yellow ribbon around something. Something good has begun. The boy in the middle, he sits down to pray. He moves to the window. I can see him as he waves. Hey, Mac, look out. Mac calls back, Billy, I'll be careful. I'm just trying to be brave. So tie yellow ribbon around something. Something lives beyond the grave.
To Radio Orbit with Mike Hagen on KOPN 89.5 FM.
That's right, this is Mike Hagen, and you are listening to KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. The name of this program is Radio Orbit. All right, our guest tonight, his name is Neil Adams. Neil is an American comic book and commercial artist. He's best known for a beautiful natural style of illustration that he's demonstrated for many, many years. He's helped create some of the definitive modern imagery of the comic strip characters, including Batman, the X-Men, and Green Arrow. But aside from his artistic flair, he has a deep interest in the sciences and is introducing ideas and theories that are rocking some establishment boats in geology and planetary science. And we'll talk a lot about this with him tonight and begin right now. So, Neil Adams, hello and welcome to Radio Orbit. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
That song you just had on reminded me very much of a little project that I worked on recently.
Is that right? What is it?
For Roger Waters.
Roger Waters of Pink Floyd fame?
Of Pink Floyd. He's doing a song in his concert tour called Leaving Beirut.
Really?
And it's basically a song about him, autobiographical in nature, about him when he was 17 years old and in Beirut and traveling through the country. And he's befriended by an accountant who is crippled, and he doesn't have any money. He runs out of gas with his buddy, and he gets taken in by this guy and this man's wife with a hunchback, and they have a baby, and they give up everything for him just as a house guest. The woman gives up her food, they give up their bed for him, and he gets a little upset about the present administration and what's going on over there, and it's pretty dramatic song. He does it in the middle of his concert, and basically quiets the audience down and does it. And thing about it is that he does it with a slideshow.
Amazing.
And the slideshow is basically, since you can't go back in time and take photographs, it's drawings by my friend Bill Sienkiewicz and myself that he blows up on the screen and puts these comic book captions on it and reads the thing and tells the story in song. And some people get a little upset. Most people think it's pretty good.
Oh, my God. You want to hear something amazing? Neil, in 1989, just after the wall, the Berlin Wall came down, I was working in southern Germany at the time. And in June or July of 1990, Roger Waters did a concert in Berlin, right at Brandenburger Tor. And it was called, and he basically did, it was a major production of The Wall, the old Pink Floyd thing. But it was this big, major production that was done prior to the reunification of East and West Germany, and there were 300,000 or 400,000 people there. It was outrageous, and all kinds of different performers there, and it's amazing. It seems like the same thing is happening again.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting that what happens is that if things go wrong and things are needed to be right, very often the things that make them right are not the big explosions and the things that you read in the news all the time. Sometimes they're just little drops of rain by individuals around the world who start to make a difference. And Roger, I guess, is one of those folks who makes slightly bigger drops of water.
Boy, oh boy, you're not kidding.
And we were very fortunate to be involved in his project. So I think it's probably going to be done. Sounds like it. He's asked us if he can do it as a book as well. It's a comic book, of course. But
wow, that's something to look forward to.
Yes, I think so.
How can people find out about it?
I guess, you know, you go to YouTube, and in fact, they have a YouTube has done a section that's on that particular song. If you go to YouTube for Roger Waters and go to the Leaving Beirut song, you'll actually see it, and you'll see my drawings. If you're not sick of them by now, you'll be able to see that whole song done. It's quite dramatic. I mean, they've chosen to put that one song up. Very powerful.
All right. Well, I thank you for bringing it up, and I thank my friend Lizzie West and her partner there for making some great music too. She's a wonderful artist here locally in Colombia. So, all right. Well, Neil, let's see. Before we get going here, we're going to talk mostly about scientific notions and this sort of thing tonight. But I've had at least a few requests for you to talk about your artistic career, and I usually like to start with background anyway. So let's start with a bit about yourself and your background, sort of how you got where you are, and you know, talk a little bit about your art or whatever, if you like.
Well, it's kind of boring.
I doubt that.
I'll talk about it. I started in comics and doing comic books. I actually had to make a choice in my early life. I was raised rather poor at a particular time, and I couldn't go to college, and I was interested in science, and I was interested in art. And amazingly, the art actually would have paid off earlier, so I did that. And so I kept up my interest in science and engineering, and I've done, outside of doing comic books, I do a lot of stage work, and I do amusement park ride designs and stuff like that for you know, the various amusement parks around the country. And you have to know quite a bit of engineering to be able to do that. So so if people don't fall off the ride. So we don't want that.
You know, there was something on the AOL front page this morning about some bunch of people got stuck upside down on a roller coaster.
Yes, we don't do that. You know, most roller coasters are gravity rides. They're not supposed to do that. And when you start putting too much machinery in it, then suddenly people get stuck.
Figures.
Anyway, I've been able to keep a lot of science in what we do, doing 3D and doing this various technical things, designing stages that won't kill people and things like that. But essentially, in the comic book field, which I have found myself delighted to be in, it started off, when I started off, the comic books were doing badly in America. There's a guy named Frederick Wortham who wrote a book called The Seduction of the Innocent. In the 50s, this is when I was a child, and implied that so many things were attributable to science, to comic books, that people should throw their comic books away. You know, a kid was bashes a cop over the head, and they look in his closet, and they discover there are comic books there. So obviously there's a direct connection to that.
Of course.
And so that was a really terrible thing. While the rest of the world was reading their comic books and delighted, and America basically turned against comic books. They were a little better than toilet paper. And so I came out of that time, and as coming out of that time, I did a syndicated strip. I did advertising comics. I couldn't get into comics. Then late in the 60s, I managed to get into comics at a place called Warren Publishing, and then I moved to DC and then to Marvel.
And were you ever doing comics for, like, papers and things like that? For newspapers?
Yeah, I did a syndicated strip based on the Ben Casey TV series.
Believe it or not, I do remember Ben Casey. Yeah.
All right. So I did a strip based on that. It was pretty sophisticated and pretty good strip, but it really wasn't that interesting. Comic books are tremendously interesting because you don't think of them that way, but they're basically an American art form. If you ever travel to France and ask a dilettante over there, which you really don't want to talk to because they are a pain in the rectum, but if you do talk to them, they will say that America contributed three things to the culture of the world. They contributed jazz, American musical comedy, and comic books. So, of course, since they are the arbiter of good taste in the world, they must be right. So we have contributed, among other things, comic books. Comic books have, in the last 30 years, have really come along. I mean, now you can't go to a movie theater without having half the pictures previewing products from comic books. You can't do computer games without having comic book computer games. You can't watch television without seeing things like Heroes and all the new shows that are coming with people with some superpowers and all this
strange
stuff. It's happening everywhere. So comics have gone from the trash heap in the middle and late 50s into a tremendous cultural movement in America. I had some part in that. I was one of those people who basically went to the comic book publishers and said, look, you may not believe in the future of comic books, but I do. And I'm going to do good comic books. And you know what you're going to do? You're going to return the original art. You're going to give us percentages. And you're going to make sure that the creators are taken care of. And they said no. So I had a little bit of a fight for a few years.
Amazing.
But I won because they were wrong.
Right. Let me ask you a question, maybe a little bit of a left-field one. But, you know, I always thought, and I loved comic books when I was a kid, and I grew up in I was born in 64. So by the time I was able to read comic books, it was, you know, early 70s and this. But I was lucky enough that one of my cousins was a collector and had a bunch of older stuff, too, like from the 50s and that.
Right.
And when I learned about World War II, and the reason I ask this is because I wonder if it's related to this thing about that you're talking about how comic books sort of got a bad rap. But I think back about when I was learning about World War II and Hitler and the V-2 rockets bombing in from, you know, from the sky onto England and master races.
Well,
and all this stuff.
That's how kids learn their history.
But, I thought that was as comic book a story as ever. I mean, the whole Third Reich thing.
Yeah, you have to remember that although people did put down comic books in America for a bunch of years, the fact of the matter is that comic books has always been the cultural medium for kids in America.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've switched kind of to adults an awful lot, but if you think about it, people will say, well, you know, I get children's books for my kids, and my kids love children's books, and I don't let them read comic books. The thing about comic books that you have to understand is that comic books are the books that kids buy with their own money.
Right.
No kid goes to a bookstore and buys a children's book.
Right, trigonometry.
If he's got money in his pocket, he'll buy a comic book.
If he's worth his salt.
And if you read comic books, one of the things you'll find is that it's not children's language. When you were a kid and you were reading comic books, there were words you didn't understand. You had no idea what regime meant and all these other things.
Right.
But you would go and find out, and you would talk to your friends, and you would read the sentence over and over again to understand what that word meant. You built up a vocabulary. Kids who read comic books are probably the most educated people in America.
Oh, and I mean, and they're language dense. I mean, I remember looking at the bubbles, you know, coming out of these characters. And I mean, God, there was a lot of text on one
That's
page,
right.
man.
Not only a lot of text, but if you compare that to See Spot Run, there really is no comparison.
Right, right, right.
So we, in the comic book business, we not only that, not only do we educate, but I'm not making a point of that because comic books do not intend to educate. They simply educate as a byproduct of the medium.
Mm-hmm.
We intend to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
So you learn a lot of what you learn about history on television. You can watch the History Channel. If you're a kid, if you make it really interesting, you can learn stuff. Sesame Street teaches you a lot of things. What you find is that people are being educated through their medium, because medium is making it entertaining. Oh, excuse me, entertaining. That's
mm-hmm.
terrible.
Huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't want my kids to be entertained. I want them to be educated.
Mm.
You know, it goes back to the wall. Excuse me.
Right, right, right.
We
right.
don't need no education.
That's right.
We don't need no thought control.
The teacher, leave them kids alone.
Exactly.
Man. Yeah.
Let's give them some entertainment with their education. You know, that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So
I love John Cage. You know, talked about purposeless play, and how this was the way to learn primarily through fun and play.
Of course.
Yeah.
So people who do comic books have that sense of responsibility. Not only do we do books that tend to educate simply because they're entertaining, but we do books about things. We believe in good people. We believe in the right. We believe in justice and truth and all those really corny things. I do.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in all that stuff. You know, if you scratch me, you know what you get? You get a loyal American. And people say, well, loyal American, that's kind of corny, isn't it? And I say, yeah. So, what's your problem?
Right.
Because when you do, it's sort of like becoming a cop. You know, you have taken upon yourself a certain responsibility to tell moral stories and stories that represent truth and justice in the American way. So comic books also represent that to kids and to adults. They represent a communication on a level of where good is good, and it's very positive. And, you know, we try not to put too much of the gray stuff in there. You know, the gray is kind of snuck in there as time has gone by, but
right.
we do believe in those things. So comic books are also good moral structural lessons for people who want to accept them. And if they don't, then, you know, the hell with them.
Right.
Don't read comic books.
That's
go
right.
read,
go
you
read
know, Dostoevsky if you want to. You know, you got time in your life to do that.
Mm.
So you know, it's a really wonderful business to be in. And those movies that they're now making really also represent that same kind of, you know, good versus evil, you know, justice and all the rest of that. So
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, I live in a very wonderful world. Think about it.
Yeah.
You know, I get to do comic books and people give me money. I do it for free.
Right. There's a tip for you young people out there, right? Okay, when did you get interested in the sciences? I guess obviously you said engineering was an interest for sort of necessary reasons.
Well, I was interested in sciences all my life, and I was interested in all the sciences. I love the idea of discovery. I used to read science books like other people would read mystery books. You know, we'd read the experiments, and you'd wonder what would happen, and the next page would be the conclusion, you know, and then you'd read the conclusion. Oh, really? And it would blow up? That's wonderful. Especially those things that would blow up, you know.
Oh, yeah, those were the
burn
best.
Through the table.
If there was magnesium, I loved it,
oh,
you know.
Oh, God. And I would read them like a mystery. I'd hold the page. I go, okay, what would happen? And then you turn, got it.
Right, right.
So for for me, science is life. And the thing about science is, for me, just like everything else, when I got into comic books, the injustice and the stupidity of comic books had to be overcome because it was stupid, and everybody that did it was wrong. And so I had to say, no, you're doing wrong. The creators of Superman, I had a big campaign for the creators of Superman. They were basically being cast aside by the business, and so I had a little bit of a battle. It's a long story, but you know, there's some things you look at and you say, gee, that's wrong. You know, that shouldn't be. Why don't I do something about that? Or you say, let somebody else do something about that. Mm-hmm. My problem is, early in my life, I was one of those people who said, let's do something about that.
Right.
So if I thought I could. Now, in science, there's lots of things that happen in all areas of science that you kind of look at and you go, a particle, a light is a particle and a wave? I don't get that. That doesn't make any sense to me. It's got to be one or the other, right? Mm-hmm. And they would bother you, you know. And if you'd argue with your teacher, you know, the teacher would say, shut up. It's going to be on the test that on Friday, and you better know.
Right, answer it this way.
And so this is the answer, so answer it. So things like that bothered me a lot in science, because I love science. Science is so precise in science. Science is so right. And everything about science that really works always works. That's the thing about science, is it always works, like a computer. Somebody says, my computer is down, it's very touchy. And you go, no, it's not touchy, you just screwed it up. You just don't know how to operate the computer, and that's why it's not, because the computer is perfect. It'll never make a mistake unless it runs out of power or something, or if something fuses in it.
Yeah.
It's you, because the computer can't make a mistake. That's how science is. Science doesn't fail you if you do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like science, and when it does fail you, it bothers me. And when and so my interest in science has just always been there. Then there was this thing that happened in the 60s, and essentially the idea of tectonics became very, very powerful. You know, when you were a little kid, well, maybe not you, but when I was a little kid, you know, you look at South America and you look at Africa, and you kind of go, well, they look like they fit together.
That's right. I mean, I thought it when I was just a kid. Sure.
Exactly.
I mean, we had the little, you know, the little 1 foot diameter spinning globe
yeah.
in my sister's bedroom or something. You know,
you'd sit and look at that thing and you go, God, it looks like it fits together.
Right. I certainly thought
so.
That.
Alfred Wegener, this guy named Alfred Wegener, thought the same thing, and he argued for a long time that they did fit together. They were actually together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, that was a ridiculous idea, but people started to think about it, because they did seem to fit together. And if you kind of check things, and as you investigated dinosaurs, you discovered that there were certain dinosaurs that were on all 7 continents.
Mm-hmm.
Allosaurus, there were everywhere. How could that be? You know, unless they were together.
Right.
And so they started to put this together, and in the 60s it became almost a theory. And the theory was that all the continents were together on one big giant island on one side of the Earth.
And this is Pangaea?
And this is Pangaea. And so you kind of look at that and you go, ah, great, they were all together. I got it. That's why there were these same dinosaurs. That's why plants in Europe are like plants in North America.
Right, same Earth has been found here and there and this sort of thing.
And they did tectonic matching. They did, you know, tectonic matching of Spain and North America, and it all matched. So they said, hey, guess what? We have this theory. I got this theory. All the continents were together on one side of the Earth, and they formed this big island, and it had to be a big island. They were all together, and now we're going to give it a name. It took them about 3 years to give it a name, Pangaea. Oh, that's great. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, that is, it's justified all these things that I thought when I was a kid, and I thought about it, and then I thought, wait a second. Hold on. I like this. I love it, but, you know, I'm going to get my little spaceship, and I'm going to jink across space, and I'm going to approach this planet, and I'm going to get to this planet. It's got, on one side, like an eyeball, it's got this one big giant island. Then I'm going to travel around this planet, and it's going to be ocean 3 miles deep.
So this is the idea that the Earth is the same size and that everything is ocean, but the land mass is all in one spot.
Yeah, that's sort of what they said.
All right.
And I thought, that's the craziest planet I've ever seen in my life. Let me go to Mars. Everything's kind of spread out, you know, and there are some big uplands and stuff, but, and then I go to the moon, you know, and it's like that. And anything you kind of see, it's all kind of regularly distributed. This seems like, I mean, somebody's once again saying that Earth is the most unique planet in the universe. It's got all the land somehow on one side of the planet, like it floated there on the ocean, and it's all collected in this one big giant island. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes sense, but it doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. How could that be? I mean, did, you know, nature come along and push all these continents together, crash, and they're on one side like that? What's mm-hmm. Wouldn't that unbalance the planet? I mean, it just seems so nuts. Then this guy from Australia, a guy named Professor Samuel Warren Carey, professor of geology, wrote a book and made an announcement that, wait a second, this isn't the way it happened. The Earth was smaller. And yes, all these continents fit together as one big giant island on a smaller Earth. And it covered the whole Earth. And I thought, my God, of course. That's how it had to be. But how could the Earth grow? I mean, that's preposterous. But still, a way better idea. I mean, it's a way better idea that, you know, the Earth was smaller. It was all the continents were all together, but they were on one Earth, and then it grew, and they cracked apart, and they spread apart. That made more sense. So I thought, well, do they check the Pacific Ocean to see if tectonic matching matches up, you know, all the continents on the in the Pacific?
Mm-hmm.
And do animals, did animals travel across the Pacific from, like, China to North America?
Right.
No, they didn't. And if you read people being interviewed, and based on Carey's announcement, they go, well, why would we have to? That's ridiculous. You know, you're not going to check that out because, of course, it couldn't be. That would mean that the Earth would grow. And there's no mechanism for the growth of the Earth. And so I would read these articles, and I go, my God, but this guy is right. What's wrong with these people? I mean, aren't they willing to check it? I mean, minimum, check it. Hello? Can I call the National Geographic Survey? Can you check the Pacific and see whether or not there's tectonic matching there? Well, no, they didn't do it.
Hey Neil.
Yeah.
A little clarification for people who aren't quite familiar with what tectonic matching is. How do they do it?
Well, I don't know how they do it. But
what's the purpose?
But the idea is that you have what you call different kinds of rock, you know, and then you have sedimentary rock, and then you have, you know, the different kinds of metamorphic rock
mm-hmm.
in different layers. So if you're going to match an area, you want to go, well, there's this amount of metamorphic rock and this amount of sedimentary rock. Well, this area didn't have much sediment, so sedimentary rock would be very low. And here it had lots of sediment, so we got a half a mile thick of sedimentary rock. So what about if you come to, let's say, North America, let's check the sedimentary rock and let's check the different rocks there and see if they sort of match.
Mm-hmm.
And check, you know, the different kinds of rock and what they're made out of, you know, how much volcanic material is there, and see whether or not there's some kind of a match across the ocean.
And in the Atlantic, they found a pretty good correlation.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they didn't check the Pacific.
Okay.
They have, by the way, checked the Pacific.
Yes, which is causing some trouble, I imagine.
Yes, not so good. It was not a happy situation. And so they don't talk about it. So you want to talk to a geologist and you want to make him go quiet, you go, what about Rodinia? And he'll go, well, of course, Rodinia, that was, a much more ancient time. And then you turn to somebody and say, what's Rodinia? What am I asking this guy about? And you'll discover that, well, guess what? There was a big giant island in the Pacific as well. And all the backsides of all the continents apparently were together on a big giant island in the Pacific, and then it broke apart, and all those islands traveled around the world to the other side, and they crashed together, and they became Pangaea. And you kind of go, really? That's
yeah. And I got a bridge for you in South Florida. Right?
Yeah, right. So now that, of course, I learned that much later. The more I learn, the more crazy it gets. So I'm thinking, this guy Carey, you know, he's got it on the ball. This is like, wow. This guy is answering all the questions. He talks about geology. He talks about, you know, tectonic matching and all the rest of it. He's a geologist. He's got it. He's studied this stuff apparently for like 25 years before. I mean, he was part of this whole Pangaea tectonic thing. And then he said, hey, wait a second. Let's take it one step further. Instead of saying, yeah, it was all together, Africa and South America match. By the way, Africa and South America don't match. They not only don't match, but if you were to take your local globe and you were to trace off South America and bring it over next on tracing paper and bring it over next to Africa and stick it under the armpit of Africa there, there's a 25-degree slice between the two. They don't match. But if you were to take, if you were to trace Africa and South America on two pieces of tracing paper and go to a globe or a ball that's about half that size, put them together, geometry will make those pieces, those tails, come together perfectly.
Interesting, because you know, I've recognized that, again, even as a younger person, I remember thinking, well, it looks like it fits, but not quite.
But not
quite. Yeah.
Just need to put them on a smaller globe.
Very interesting.
And they go together perfectly, because that's geometry. And you know, the funny thing about geologists is they study geology, but they don't study geometry. And they don't study physics. Because what we have in the world is we have specialization.
Oh my gosh, I know.
You understand?
I do.
Now, in specialization, you have people studying these various things, and if you have communications between this guy and this guy, this guy over here will say, well, you're going into physics here, and I'm really not big on physics. And you go to the geologist, and he'll say, well, you know, or go to the physicist, he'll say, well, yes, well, of course, I'm a physicist. I'm not very big on geology. And you kind of go, can't you guys come together in a room and share this information?
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah, they could both help each other considerably. Right.
So what happens? Carrie is like starting to make a big fuss, and people are paying attention, something that's forgotten these days. People were paying attention to Carrie, and everybody was afraid because the consequences of the thought that the Earth grew are fantastic. So unbelievable, because if the Earth grew, I mean, gravity had to change, but forget that. That would mean, by implication or by logic, that all the planets grew. That would mean that all the suns grew. That would mean that all the moons grow of a particular size. That would mean that all the solar systems and all the galaxies grew. That would mean that the universe grows, and that would mean, no Big Bang. Suddenly you're talking trouble here.
Everybody.
You guys
after the grail, yeah.
You guys go in the back room there and have your little plotting things and whatever that is. We don't want to hear about this because you're getting into the big stuff here.
Right.
Now, wait a second, but isn't it a clue? If the Earth grew, isn't it a different view of the universe? You can't just say the Earth grew. Oh, the Earth grew. No, you can't say that. Sorry. That's a no-no, can't do that. Wait a second. But weren't dinosaurs about four times bigger than animals today, as if they were in a much lower gravity? Not a half-size gravity, but a quarter of the gravity?
Yeah, that's another
Sauropods weighed 40 tons. Tyrannosaurus rex was the size of an elephant and ran. They even have paleontologists who get on Discovery, and there'll be this paleontologist over here with a beard, and he'll say, T-Rex ran, and there'll be this other paleontologist who'll say he couldn't run, he was too heavy. If he ran faster than 10 miles an hour, his head would snap off as he turned. And they actually have arguments. There's a show that has this happening, insisting that that's impossible. But you know, if the gravity was less and the Earth was smaller, the argument wouldn't even exist.
Interesting.
Sauropods that have straight legs like elephants weighed 40 to 50 tons. Tyrannosaurus rex that has a back leg that's bent and has a Achilles tendon on it that's as thick as a, I can't think of the analogy, as thick as the arm of your chair, that are shaped like tiger's back legs and lion's back legs, weighed 10 tons.
Amazing.
10 tons. It's not possible. See, I study anatomy, too. The bad thing is I study all this stuff.
Right, right.
I study anatomy. I'm a pretty good anatomist. Most people who know anything about art will tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it looks like to have a leg that can fire like a rocket. You're talking about a Tyrannosaurus rex that could run top speed 70 miles an hour and turn on a dime.
Wow.
In this gravity, his head would snap off.
Gotcha.
It is true.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Hey, look, Neil, I think it's a good opportunity to take a little break, okay?
Sure, you bet.
All right, let's do it. And we'll come back in just a few minutes to talk a little bit more. Everybody, it's Neil Adams and wonderful stuff that Neil is sharing with us tonight. You can find out more about him and the work that he does and has done on the web at Neil, N-E-A-L, Adams, A-D-A-M-S.com, neiladams.com. You can link over there from my site as well. We'll come back with Neil in just a few minutes here. In the meantime, we'll play another one from Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. This is a song called God Damn That Man. It's Mike. We'll be back in just a minute. It's Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Go and do it again.
Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. This is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. We've got Neil Adams with us from his home in New York. I'm guessing New York City.
Yep.
And it's a pleasure to have him with us. And Neil, thanks for sticking around. I've got, and you are, you're in the city, Neil?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Neil, before we go any further, a question came up during the break there about subduction. And I think this is something that's important if we're talking about tectonics, because I think it sort of closes the book. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, what happened was that in the middle of this debate, a fellow by the name of Wadati and a fellow by the name of Benioff were doing seismic readings are in the Pacific, and they discovered what is called a subducting slab off the island of Tonga. I believe it was Tonga. Anyway.
And a subducting slab is a part of the Earth's...
Yeah, the idea is that the oceanic crust, which is the second crust of the Earth, you have the upper tectonic crust, which are the continents, which are between 1 and 4.5 billion years old, and then you have the oceanic crust, which is no older than 180 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make that comparison, put that in your head. 180 million, not quite 200 million,
okay.
And billions of years for the continents.
Okay.
One of those chunks of oceanic crust seemed to, and was recorded to, go dive down into the the rest of the crust, and what they call subduct or go under the other crust. From that, the geological community said, well, that's a new theory here. That's a thing that will make it very, very easy for us to argue with Mr. Carey, because what we'll say is, and this is the theory that developed, that oceanic crust and continental crust subducts under other oceanic crust and continental crust. It got to be pretty dramatic. They even said that continents went under continents in those days, and that essentially that we were floating on an ocean of magma all around the world, and the pieces were breaking and subducting under other pieces. A lot has changed since then. Things have evolved quite differently than that. But in those days, that was the way that geology got out of Sam Carey's eagle eye.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, subduction allows us to say that oceanic crust dives under other oceanic crust or under the continents and essentially gets remelted and becomes part of the asthenosphere,
mm-hmm.
which is under... Anyway, so that was... And I'm, you know, like I'm one of those... people who goes, well, science is science. That must be the way it is.
Sure. I mean, that
makes all the sense in the world.
That's what I mean.
Is eating itself, which is sort of like the dog ate my homework. Dog, honey, what did you do with your homework? The dog ate it, Daddy. Okay, ate it all. Were there any little scraps left?
No,
they're all. It's all gone.
Nope.
So. In this discussion, you know, I, as much as I was impressed by this whole thing, you know, because, you know, I love science, it didn't seem as though there were any scraps left. It seemed somehow that the oceanic crust managed to eat all of the ancient oceanic crust completely.
Mm-hmm.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Now, what that meant was, and of course, in amongst all of this stuff, they were doing things like, well, how old is the oceanic crust? I mean, really, how old is it? Why don't we send out these ships and discover how old the oceanic crust is? Because some weird things are happening. Like, you know, the ship that worked for the telephone company called the Long Lines, they would lay cables across the ocean.
Right,
and
right.
A certain point, that cable would, like, get disrupted and seem to burn through. And they discovered that in the mid-ocean, there were these rifts that were volcanic in nature.
Which were expanding, right?
Yes, we're spreading, actually. We're spreading the ocean floor out sideways to either side.
Uh-huh.
That was very impressive. And that was the reason that, of course, the oceans were spreading. It was possible for the oceans to spread. So they said, well, we'll go down and we'll test how old the ocean floor is. Because, you know, the funny thing is... paleontologists aren't able to find many ancient fish bones down there. So anyway, they sent the ships out, and the U.S. Navy helped out, and they discovered in the first 10 years that they couldn't find any part of the ocean that was older than 70 million years old. It's about when the dinosaurs died off. So they kept on going out, and then they found there were certain areas of the ocean that were as much as 180 million years old. But there were very little small areas, like there's a little area off the east coast of North America, a little area off the coast of Africa, which kind of fit together. And in the west, in the western Pacific, there's a circular area, very odd circular area, as if something spread out like an iris from this old area.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was, presumably, is that the ocean, all the ocean that we have now, is no older than 180 million years old. There's not a square inch anywhere. I mean, you kind of think, well, they have this thing that they labeled subduction, and essentially what's supposed to happen is one plate slides under another plate. So you kind of figure, well, the plate that it slides under, as long as it's the plate that's being slid under, is probably older than the one that's sliding under it, because it's been sliding for a long time. So we'll go to that plate, and we'll check how old it is. Well, unfortunately, that plate is no older than 180 million years old. In fact, most of it is younger. In effect, the dog did eat all the homework.
Hey, Neil?
Yeah.
A question comes up in email about your confidence in dating techniques and this sort of thing. And this has come up before with me, and when people talk about deep time and this. How confident
are
you
that
things
are
dated?
I'll tell you the truth. There's what I would call, I give things percentages.
Uh-huh.
Okay? There's things that seem to be pretty good. You get a good percentage. If you get, 70 or 80% and it seems to check with the facts, I give it an awful lot of credit. If it's 70, 80%, not that it's people's opinions, but it seems to check out. You check it here, it works. You check it over here, it works. You check it over here, it works. Seems to be pretty good. I'm okay with that. I don't have a real big problem with dating. So, unless somebody comes up with some big, theory that says, no, this is no good, and not based on faith or anything, obscure and weird, I'll buy it. I'm fine. I really do like science.
Mm-hmm.
Really do like science. Carrie came up with a great theory, and it was stronger than the theory that was extant, okay,
mm-hmm.
except that there was this subduction. Very impressive, this subduction. So, of course, I've studied subduction and the various aspects of subduction since then. I remember when this whole thing started that essentially geologists said that continents spin around and crash into each other like bumper cars in a carnival. It's one of the favorite phrases coming out of the 60s and going into the 60s. Crashed around like bumper cars in a carnival. And I thought, do they think it's floating on water? I mean, what kind of attitude is that? I mean, don't you have to have some kind of proof that it's doing that? I don't think that's really the case. I look at these undersea maps, and everything seems very logical and very sensible. You can see the spreading, and they made spreading maps of the undersea. There's a thing called the crustal map that the National Geographic Survey has. It's a kind of a rainbow of spreading, and you can look at that and study that very, very carefully, and you start to see things that are, and what you see is there's very logical spreading from the rift areas, and there's no moving around and bumping. In fact, they said, well, this is how we made mountains. We made mountains by continents crashing into one another. Now, since then, what we've discovered is about 80%, if not more, of the mountains on Earth have been created in the last 50 million years since the dinosaurs died. In fact, in the ages of the dinosaurs, there were no mountains. Oh, there were hills and there were areas you had to go over, but there were no mountains. You kind of go, no mountains? Wait a second. Okay, Carrie was wrong. We'll say that Carrie was wrong. But aren't you describing a world that's very, very different back in those days? I mean, if all the continents were together, dinosaurs could migrate hemispherically. They could migrate because there weren't mountains to cross. Because now you're saying there weren't mountains to cross. But you're saying that mountains are caused by continents crashing into one another. Hold on a second. In the last 50 million years, how many continents crashed into one another?
Right. They
I mean,
that,
you can
right.
say if they crashed into one another 300, 400, a billion years ago, they made mountains. But these guys over here are telling me that the Himalayas were made in the last 30 million years. The Rocky Mountains were made in the last 30 million years. The Andes were made in the last 20 to 30 million years. Hold it. Those are the biggest mountain ranges on Earth.
Right, so the timelines don't jive.
They don't jive in any way. Mm-hmm. So how is this explained? Another thing that's very, very odd, too, is that in the ages of dinosaurs, there were, as I said, there were no deep oceans because there's no fish fossils. So you say, well, where do you get fish fossils? You get them in Utah.
Yeah, in the highlands of Colorado and stuff.
That's right. You get them in Italy. You get them in China. You get them on the mountains. Wait a second. Ancient fish fossils, you can't get them in the deep oceans because the deep oceans didn't exist because the Earth ate it. Okay, but it ate every bit of it. There's not a square yard of deep ocean in the ocean. Mm. Somehow this particular vacuum cleaner called subduction managed to eat every square yard of the deep oceans.
Right.
And the only place that we find ancient fish fossils is on the land. Now, why is that? Well, they tell you, if you study enough different sciences, one of the things they'll tell you is, two-thirds of the continental plates, approximately, were covered with what they call shallow seas. In fact, the whole Midwest of the American continent was covered with a shallow sea for the ages of the dinosaurs. Well, wait a second. Doesn't that mean, how deep were these shallow seas? Well, they were like a half mile deep. They weren't really shallow. They weren't like, puddles. They were seas. In fact, if the Earth were smaller and you put all the continents together, it would still look like the Earth because the shallow seas look like the oceans. If you go to the Great Lakes, which are fairly small, and you look across any Great Lake, you're looking, in your mind, across an ocean. You can get in a plane and fly across it, and you can't see the other side.
Right.
Because it's big, okay? So these shallow seas that covered portions of the land were a half mile deep. All the dinosaur type of reptiles and fish that swam in those oceans, the megalodonts and sharks and all the rest of those, lived in these shallow seas. You say, well, did they live in the deep ocean? Well, they must have lived in the deep ocean. No, there's not too many things in the deep ocean, There's not too many fish families down there now. Evolution would say there's a lot down there, but, the funny thing is they're not. They're shallow sea creatures. And they're now in the shallow ocean, but they're not in the deep ocean. You don't find many fish down there.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few fish families. In fact, if you were to check fish families, what you'd discover is there is more than twice as many fish families that live on the continental waters as live in the shallow ocean. And there are far more than twice as many fish families that live in the shallow ocean that live in the deep ocean.
Mm-hmm, I agree. Yeah.
Evolution doesn't work that way. Mm. Works the opposite way. Where it's there, life continues and builds. If there were deep oceans for 2 billion years, there would be lots of fish down there. They're not. They're only in the shallow seas and on the land, and there's more on the land than there are in the ocean. So you had shallow seas on the land, and you go, well, how deep were they? Well, a half mile. Hold on a second. You're saying that sea level was a half mile deeper then than it is now. That's about minimum a quarter of what would be the ocean now, because you're saying sea level isn't just, over there. It's the whole world. So you're saying that the ocean, the sea level, was a half mile deeper for the whole world. What happened to that water? It's gone. There are no shallow seas on any continental plate, anywhere. Don't exist. What happened to it? Well, according to Carey, and according to me now, because, of course, I'm digging my heels into this, that what happened was the Earth grew, the plates cracked because they became profound and the cracks became deeper, and the water that was on the land simply drained off into the new, deeper oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes too much sense for me. I mean, I don't have an argument against that. The dinosaurs, which were four times as big as the animals now, migrated hemispherically because they could migrate anywhere in the world they wanted to as long as they went around the oceans. The reptiles stayed at the equator and ate them as they went by. That's how you get 25 and 26 to 35-foot crocodilians that died off when the dinosaurs died off. So you had a smaller world where dinosaurs migrated hemispherically from the summer to the summer. Reptiles killed them off, and they were doing fine until the Earth started to crack and the continents started to spread apart, oh, about 64 million years ago. And then the dinosaurs died because they couldn't migrate.
So as far as the timeline goes, you think that there's been an expansion or a growth of the Earth in the reasonably recent future? In other words, 70 million years isn't that long in deep time.
That's right. It's not very long. But what's happened is that the Earth has grown exponentially. That is, it's increased with time. Now, one of the things you can do if you want to is you can go to the National Geographic Survey and you can get that crustal map and you can look at. They actually separate it very badly. I do a much better job because I break it into 10 million year jumps. But if you check it out and you look at it very carefully, what you'll see is that the newer pull aparts, the newer spreads, are much bigger and cover much more territory than something that happened 100 million years ago or 150 million years ago, even smaller. So what's happened is that the Earth has grown increasingly over time. In fact, in the ages of the dinosaurs, okay, and the ages of the dinosaur extinction, let's say 60 million years ago, half of the ocean, the deep oceans that we had existed. The other half has grown, has spread in the last 60 million years, whereas the previous half grew in the previous 120 million years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's not a linear acceleration.
No, it's exponential.
See, that's cool because that sort of jives with some of my other ideas that I'm sort of in tune with. I'm sort of like eschatology, and the idea that time itself is accelerating is something that I sort of buy into. It sort of feeds into that. At any rate,
that may be true, but remember, I'm hard science.
Yes. Go ahead.
I believe
in
hard science.
Okay. All right.
And if you want to see how it happens, they actually have maps. They have maps that show the oceanic spread in over the last 180 million years. National Geographic Survey has it. And if you check it out carefully and you start measuring with your calipers and your rulers, you'll discover that it's an exponential growth. So here you have the dinosaurs trying to survive because the crust of the Earth is growing very, very slowly. Okay, so it's stretching and it's leaving areas for shallow seas, which are not deep breaks and deep spreads. So it's kind of stretching until suddenly, and it's not suddenly, I say suddenly,
right,
advisedly.
Right.
What happens is the growth speeds up enough, that a rift that happens that might have been just a spread that would happen over 2 million years happens over maybe 100,000 years. And it cracks apart all the way down to what would be the magma, very, very far down. And starts pulling apart. Now, in an area, let's say the Gulf of Mexico, starts to pull apart. As it pulls apart, the North American continent is on the rift line, so it kind of shifts to the left. Now, if you look at your map, you'll see that it looks like North America shifted to the left, and Central America kind of swung to the right as it went down to South America. Kind of swings to the right. So you get this pulling to the side. Now, what happens when that happens is you get pressure, and the pressure will help to push the mountains up. Now you have dinosaurs that are trying to travel from North America to South America and to Antarctica, which was subtropical at the time. And they travel on these land bridges, and they do fine until the Gulf of Mexico opens up too much. Then it's a little harder for them to get there. Now they want to get there because down there, the fruit is just starting to pop out. Of course, there is no fruit, but the grasses and the plants are starting, they're starting to become seasonal. As time has gone by, we started with a planet that had subtropical weather all over the planet. Suddenly, we're starting to get oceans. The oceans are cold. The seasons are starting to increase in their nature. Plants are starting to go from annuals to seasonal plants. Suddenly, when summer comes to one hemisphere, there's more plants and more things to eat. And then the next season, there's less.
Mm. Yeah, okay? So there's good reason to be moving about.
So they're traveling from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. How do they do that? Well, they evolve from reptiles into dinosaurs with tremendously long legs. All dinosaurs have long legs, something they don't tell you when you go to the museum. But when you go to the museum, look at the dinosaurs and you'll discover they all have long legs. Every one of them, even the fat, stumpy ones, have long legs. And they go straight down. Now, you're not going to travel very far with legs that stick out to the side, but if they go straight down, which is what dinosaur legs do, you can travel as long and as far as you want. So you can migrate hemispherically unless the land starts to break up, unless the Mediterranean starts to open around 64 million years ago, unless Australia breaks off from Asia, unless the Gulf of Mexico starts to open up. Suddenly, within a very short period of time, your dinosaurs are starting to not make it.
What
and
do
you know
mean?
What? They can't live in the hemisphere that they're at because grasses didn't evolve until 30 to 40 million years ago.
Neil, what do you make of the event or events that that triggered this whole thing? In other words, obviously 60 to 70 million years ago, or you know, maybe that's an arbitrary time frame, but whatever, everybody agrees that something significant happened around that particular geologic time.
Yeah, I think I can tell you what happened.
What's your guess?
I think that the continents began to actively rift apart. Those rifts that you see in the mid-ocean, okay, are volcanic in nature.
Right.
Except they're peaceful because they're miles below the ocean. If you have the Gulf of Mexico opening up, you can say a meteorite hit, and possibly it did. Maybe it hit at a critical time, and it killed off some animals. It certainly did kill off animals all around the world, and it didn't kill off just the dinosaurs. Excuse me. I have a card here. I'm looking for a Mr. and Mrs. Dinosaur because I don't want to kill off the mammals or the reptiles. I'm going to save the reptiles, even though they lay eggs and they're just like dinosaurs. But you know, the thing about reptiles is they don't migrate. They stay at the equator and they live at the equator. But dinosaurs, likely because they have down-facing legs, migrate hemispherically. The reason they migrate hemispherically, you could say, well, why don't they do like cows, you know? The cows can survive, they just go south. But you see, cows eat grass. They also eat dry, dead grass. But in those days, there was no grass. If you planted, took all your animals now that live today, and you took them back in time to the ages of dinosaurs and got the dinosaurs out of the way, they would die off. Why? Because there was no grass. They could not survive the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Because all grazing animals survive on even dead grass.
Right.
They kick up the snow and they eat the dead grass that's underneath it.
Amazing.
They would die. Not only that, the reason they survive a winter, our animals, is they have little heads with thick necks and practically no tail. So if you know something about farming, you know that in the wintertime when the ground freezes, a cow will sleep standing up.
Uh-huh. And a horse, too. So.
That's right. Yeah. They sleep standing up. If the ground is okay and they have enough matting, they'll lie down. But if they lie down on a frozen ground, their bellies will freeze and they will die. Dinosaurs have long necks and heads and long tails. There's no way they could not lie down. So if the ground were to freeze, they would die. They had to migrate. What is one of the biggest clues to them migrating hemispherically? Birds. The only dinosaurs that survive are those idiot birds. And birds migrate hemispherically. They don't go south for the winter. They go to the other hemisphere. If you were to say, why do they go to the other hemisphere? You could easily say, well, they go to the other hemisphere because that's their, you know, that's what they do. It's they go to get someplace warm. No, excuse me. Florida's warm. Not Africa. They fly to Africa. They fly across the equator.
Right, they don't have to go that far to go to a warm place.
It's their habit. They've been doing it for 300 million years, maybe 200 million years.
Amazing.
And so that's what they do now. They are the remnants of the dinosaurs, and they migrate hemispherically. So they originally lived on a smaller planet where they could migrate hemispherically, like Mars. Call it Mars. Call Earth Mars with rain. Okay. That is the reason that the dinosaurs existed. Think about dinosaurs. What is so wonderful about dinosaurs that they could take over the world? Well, not very much, if you think about it. First of all, they had no fur. Second of all, they laid their eggs on the ground. How stupid could you be? Okay? They grew long legs. They couldn't hibernate, and they couldn't dig tunnels or caves or holes in the ground to go into because of their long legs. Mammals could, and they had mammals had fur. They could burrow into the ground. They could hibernate. They carried their young in their bellies until they gave birth to them young. Dinosaurs didn't. Mm. They were at the whim of the planet. If the planet would change, they would die.
Right. Okay.
There's no meteorite. That's silly.
Neil, all right. Top of the hour here, plus or minus, okay?
Okay.
Let's take a little break.
Go for it.
Hey, everybody, Neil Adams with us from his place in New York City. Wonderful stuff. We're talking about the growing Earth theory, among other things. And we'll come back and talk with Neil a little bit more in just a few minutes here. On the web at Neil Adams, NEALADAMS.com, and you can link over there from my site as well. In the meantime, let's play another song here. Neil, you have about 4 minutes or so. Take a little break and get a glass of water or something, whatever you like. And we'll have a song here from Lizzie West and the White Buffalo. This is called... What did I decide to play? I forgot. Take my glasses off so I can see the damn CD. Oh, of course. Rope Me In and Smoke Me. From my Pledge Allegiance to Myself, here's Lizzie. Back in just a few minutes, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
Sitting right here, you were bending my ear, saying all the sweet things a lady wants to hear. Your hand on my knee, and it was fine with me. Your arm against my shoulder, I thought you'd get a little bolder. Oh my, oh yeah. You are gonna squeeze me, juice me and drink me. If you're gonna start me, finish the job. For a good, long, and very hard moment. And then I turned to him, and I said, are you inviting me to come? Well, I mean what I say, baby. Don't you think I mean what I say? Well, so long as you're inviting me to come, then why not go? You're gonna start me, finish the job. If you are
fruit from the tree. Then just please juice it. That's all I ask. You know? And let's have a little fun.
Yeah, let's have a little fun with Lizzie. That's Lizzie West and the White Buffalo from I Pledge Allegiance to Myself. That one's called Rope Me In and Smoke Me. I love it. Okay. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We've got Neil Adams on the line with us. Neil, thank you so much for sticking around with us late into the nighttime.
Just delightful.
Okay. A question here. If the Earth is growing and gravity is getting heavier or stronger or something like this.
It's better.
Where is the extra matter coming from?
Ah, there you go. See, now. So here was Sam Carey, right? Mm-hmm. Sam Carey had done this theory, and Sam Carey got defeated. Sam Carey has had an illustrious career and died about 3 years ago.
Okay. So he was on the scene up until just recently.
Yes, he was. And he, you know, he didn't, like, vanish into obscurity. He became a geology professor and was renowned in his area in Australia and did very well. He didn't, like, you know, was no nobody's holding any benefits for Sam Carey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But his, essentially, his great discovery was turned away from. And he was essentially intellectually disgraced. He was invited to the National Geological, the Royal Geological Academy in London to speak, and they ridiculed him there.
Well, I tell you what, that's one mark for him in my book, because most of the guys that I know who have done great work are pretty much, you know, considered heretics or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
well, there you go. Anyway, so I thought about it at the time, and I thought, and I didn't know too much about Carey. I just knew that there was this guy from Australia, and I knew that this theory was defeated by the subduction zone and the there was two things: the subduction zone thing. And I could see, you know, that's a pretty heavy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question, where is this matter coming from? And I thought, well, I don't know about the subduction zone thing, because, you know, you can certainly question that from the beginning, but it didn't seem like geology had moved very quickly forward in that area. But on the other hand, why couldn't Carey deal with this mechanism, the mechanism that made the Earth grow, that created the matter? The reason he couldn't deal with it is because he was a geologist, not a physicist.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, you know, how's he going to convince somebody, you know, to join him in this quest? There were a bunch of geologists. There were a couple of dozen geologists that agreed with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I read there, they actually have a website that survives, but it's old and it's disgraced. But you can find it.
Mm-hmm.
It exists on the Internet. He had no physicists. It's interesting. You know, I would have thought he would have gone to the physicist and said, guys, help me out here.
Right, I could use our help.
And I thought, you know, who's going to do that work? I mean, if the man's been more or less disgraced, who is going to, say, pick up the ball and go into physics? You know, I mean, you got guys with tenure, you know, who are going to lose their
mm-hmm.
tenure.
Yeah, it's a common story. Yeah.
They're going to lose their job.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to lose their friends. Who the heck is going to do this? You'd have to find somebody who was really interested in science, who could actually read and could read, you know, the books that were available and cared and was interested in finding this out because it seemed like an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Had some time on his hands, also had a job, and also had friends that couldn't give a crap about science anyway. So science is, you know, physics is one of those concepts that you could empty a room with by talking about it. You know, pretty much, you know, theoretical religion and science, physics, pretty much will empty a room in about 2 minutes.
Right.
So nobody wants to hear about it. So you could pretty much find somebody who is interested in it and let him study it to his heart's content and never have to bother with anybody if he really was interested. And he had something else to do, like have a career in old comic books. So I thought, guess what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to find that mechanism, because that's the only contribution I could make, because Sam Carey had done the rest of it. I'm going to find that mechanism, figure out what the hell it is. And I thought, about after 3 years, and what I'll do is I'll write a book. I'll write a graphic novel about two guys in a bar having a discussion about this. And so I thought I figured it out 3 years later. And I started my graphic novel, and I did the first 9 pages, which had to do with tectonics. And then I read my outline over again, and I said to myself, self, you're an idiot. I don't even understand what the hell you're driving at here. I'm not going to be convinced by this. So I thought, well, I guess I'm just going to have to study some more and nail everything down. 35 years later, I figured it out. And so I've worked on the graphic novel, and I've worked on a video, and some of the videos you see on YouTube or on my site that basically talk about the tectonics. Some of the ones that are on my site talk about the physics. So it took me 35 years to figure out the physics. And just like with tectonics, the clues have been lying around all the time.
Neil, let me mention the website since you mentioned it. Again, there is some amazing video stuff, and it's really cool how you've been using the video medium to share some of this stuff, Neil. But and in fact, let's talk about that in a minute. But the website is Neil Adams, NEALADAMS, neiladams.com. And there's a number of different sections there, but the science one is the one that we're primarily talking about tonight. And you can link over there from my site from here on out, and we'll have this program up in the program archives in the next day or so. So, Neil, talk a little bit about video and how helpful it is with what you're trying to get across.
Well, see, that's the thing is that there are various. If you go to YouTube, I've got a couple of videos up, and one of them it talks about the different guys in Europe that realized that Carey was right. This is not a small movement. One could think, well, it's Carey and 3 other guys. It's
right.
Really not.
Yeah, okay.
There are scientists all around the world who are still hold the light and believe this, and many of them are old and dying because time has gone by. There was a program done in France on this, an hour program, and I have a translation of it. And I translated a little bit of it for YouTube to show that there are some European scientists that are doing this. One of the things I found was that if you don't have the mechanism, you can sound crazy. Because what happens is, you have to, if you're a geologist or even if you're a physicist, you have to come up with some really weird theories to explain this. Oh, well, you know, the atoms are expanding. Or the Earth is expanding and it's big and hollow on the inside. Or,
Hold on. Now you're gonna have to address it real quick because I got tons of people saying, hey, Mike, let's see, could you ask him what he thinks about hollow Earth theory and would it have any connection to his ideas? Quickly, I know it's...
I'll do it. I'm shooting myself in the foot. The only place where a hollow Earth could exist is about 1,700 miles below the Earth, at the outer core of the Earth, where the seismic response changes.
So for physical reasons.
I mean, you're able to... Seismology has been able to probe the Earth, and we know that the mantle down to 1,700 miles and more is solid.
It's solid. Okay.
And then below that, it's either a liquid or a plasma. Now, I say a liquid or a plasma because I know it's a plasma, but others say that it's a liquid, which it can't be, but they say it's liquid iron. Now, that would be the only place it could exist, this hollow Earth, and the temperature down there, recently they've said, they've done experiments that tell them that the temperature there is about 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
That's about the surface of the sun.
Mm.
So if there was a hollow Earth down there, you don't want to visit. You don't want to do a day trip, even if you take, you know, those little refrigerator things you wrap around your neck. Not going to work. And the rest of it, no.
What do you think?
If you go down 10 miles, you boil.
Right.
You know, it's.
What do you think the core is made of, or do you think there's any? Or is it even worth talking about?
You go down to the inner core. It's probably like a little sun. If you got 6,000 degrees around it, it's going to be pretty hot and pretty dynamic on the inside. And the right. And the, some folks in Harvard. Harvard, of course. They're saying that the inner core of the Earth rotates faster than the Earth itself.
I've read that, yeah.
One of the proofs that it cannot be a molten core, because if it were a molten core, it would be like a stick in a pot of stuff. It would make the molten core travel at the same speed as the inner core.
Mm.
So it has to be plasma. I know there's physicists out there who are going, you're out of your mind, geologists going, he's crazy. But, you know, if the inner core is traveling faster than the outer core, then the inner core would drag the outer core to that speed. or it would slow down. So if it was molten iron and it was pressing on the inner core. So I'm sorry, I know you guys have done 15 years of research, but you're wrong. And I apologize for saying that and seeming to sound so arrogant, but really, truly can't be. It has to be plasma. Plasma is the only thing that carries, that would carry the outside of a liquid iron, would carry the electromagnetic field of the Earth.
And maintain it.
And maintain it. And it would, and it's the only thing that would allow P waves to travel through it, thus showing that it is either a liquid or a gas. And it can't be molten iron, or else it would slow down the inner core. So I'm sorry, you're wrong, folks. I know
All right.
You're angry at me, but I'm sorry.
Well,
I think
we should talk more about this, though, about this new model that you're presenting, because...
But it's physics, you know, and it's boring.
Well, I know. I mean, trust me, the people that are listening to this show are very interested in it, and they're asking hard questions. They're saying...
I'll tell you what. We'll do it this way. We're going to go back into this, okay? I'm going to back into this, and I'm going to do it like an artist, like a scientist, like somebody who is not, you know, one of these tightly trained scientists who thinks that, oh, it's the more complicated it is, the better it is.
No, the simple, probably the best it is.
Well, yes. And we've done, you know,
we're sort of Neoplatonists around here.
Right,
you know?
Okay. So we've moved back in science, and we've discovered that things were a lot simpler than we thought they were. They're made out of three things, electrons, protons, and neutrons. And when we discovered that, that made everything simple. You know, everything is made out of that. The chair, your mother, whatever, made out of electrons, protons, and neutrons.
I'm not sure about my mother.
Especially your mother. And the umbrella, you know, the phone, whatever.
She's made out of pure love,
okay.
Trust me.
Exactly, sure, as they all are. So everything's made out of these things, so it makes everything simpler. Now, you would think that, you know, going ahead, that we could find a simpler breakdown of things, and we would be, you know, we discover how things work. But no, we're not like that, because we're jerks. Humans are jerks. A lot of answers to a lot of questions happen if you just assume people are stupid and jerks. Now, I assume I am, and I get, you know, get through a lot of stuff that way. Hey, I don't know the answer because I'm stupid, you know, and I'll try to figure it out tomorrow if I can, but today, I don't know. So if it makes sense to me that things would be simpler. Now, let's just say you have this really stupid universe that doesn't really think very much. It's not going to do something very complicated. In other words, it doesn't stay up at night and go, oh, tomorrow I think I'm going to invent a quark. Tomorrow
right.
I'm going to invent a muon.
Yeah,
and the next day I'm going to, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do gravitons.
Oh, man, Neil, I'll tell you what. These big, gigantic accelerator and atom smasher, they drive me batty that they waste all this freaking money just to find the next, latest, greatest, silly particle. It's crazy.
And they love to do it, And I have discovered a couple of things.
Has anything good ever come from it for you or me? Has anything come out of it?
It must have. And I think if we had somebody to tell us, he'd probably tell us for about 8 hours. Bore the crap out of me. Guys, shut up. I don't want to hear about this anymore. So anyway, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, what matter is made? In other words, what matter do we know is made? Do we know matter is made? Any matter? And so I had to, you know, research it. This thing took me 35 years. I got to open a book sooner or later. So I'm reading stuff, and then I discover a thing called pair production. And I had to track it down to Carl David Anderson. Carl David Anderson in 1932 performed some experiments, and for which he got the Nobel Prize, because this guy named Dirac, very bright guy, said, you know, you have an electron, and it's a really simple basic particle, and it's negative. There ought to be a positive particle, like the electron.
Yeah, the positron, right?
A positron has to be, okay? So he says it, and anyway, this guy named Carl David Anderson is examining cosmic rays in this thing that he builds in his laboratory out of a barrel and some other shit,
It's all right, it's 1:30 in the morning.
And it kind of looks like a pig, you know? So he's tracking cosmic rays through this, so he's... As much as he can, he's emptying gas out of it, and he's putting in trace elements of argon and various things, glowing gases. And he starts to see these, like, things fire through it that make a little smoke in the gas.
Uh-huh.
and he sees what he calls cosmic rays. Of course, they're, you know, photons and stuff. Anyway, so he sees that, and then he sees a thing. He sees a, what looks like a collision, and then this thing fires out to the side, and he discovers that, in fact, it's a positron. Now, what steps he went through doesn't really matter, but over the next several years, he discovers the positron. The positron is the opposite of the electron. And what it does is it somehow is created by a photon seemingly hitting something, and it suddenly comes into existence, and within a nanosecond, it finds an electron and destroys it.
Right. Yeah.
So scientists, you know, whoa, matter is created here, and now matter is destroyed. That's really a bad thing. Because, you know, we have rules. You can't create anything. You can't destroy anything. Now, you've created this thing. Now it destroys an electron. That's impossible.
Mm.
So they say, I'll tell you what. It's antimatter. We'll call it antimatter.
Yes.
And that will be our excuse, and we will give something for writers to write about for the next 100 years. Antimatter. You got antimatter. It's the opposite of matter. It destroys matter. See? You made antimatter. Within a couple of years, another bunch of guys are like doing the same experiments, and discover at exactly the same time the positron is created, an electron is created. Ha! That's incredible. Now the positron goes in and kills an electron, but not the same electron, kills a different electron, and we have an electron left, so we have a balance in the universe, so everything's okay. Whew! Wow, that was close.
Wow.
Now, us logical folks go in and say, excuse me, that's a different electron. You may say nothing was created, but that electron over there, you know the one named Fred? He's still alive.
Right.
And you killed Joe, and he's dead. Now, how do you explain that? Because let's just say we're on the edge of our galaxy, and this same thing happens, and a positron electron are created, and the positron flies across the galaxy for, about 10 million light years. You've unbalanced the universe.
Right, before it gets its electron.
That's right, before it, hey, there's Fred, oop, just missed him.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole, you know, conversation and excuse-making, to me, is like, you know, some piece of very valuable stuff on the floor there that you guys kind of left there, you know, it's antimatter. I don't think that's antimatter. Mm-hmm. Isn't that just another kind of matter? Excuse me. Let's do this. We'll play a little game. Little game is this. You create two kinds of matter. You create a positron and an electron. Positron goes and kills or annihilates an electron. Okay? So now you've got one electron left. Now you had let's say you had an electron at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And now another one is made. Now you kill the other one. Okay? How can you have a universe filled with electrons if positrons are annihilating them every time they're created?
Right.
Shouldn't every electron be killed by a positron?
Right. You never have more than one. Yeah.
We've got all these electrons everywhere. They're around every one of our atoms. Right. How is that possible?
Right.
Is there another way to make them? In other words, okay, we see about pair production. Okay, seem to be made out of nothing. Poof, we got them. Now, is there another way? Like, does the Big Bang make electrons? In other words, if you can make an electron by striking something with a photon, with a high-energy photon, striking nothing, and you get an electron and a positron, are you telling me there's two ways of doing this? Because that doesn't make any sense to me. In a very primitive universe, this has got to be the only way. And, you know, the thing that made it has to be sitting around. Now, I'm going to tell you a secret. Fairly recently, they've discovered that, you know, that positron-electron annihilation that goes on doesn't really go on. What really happens is the positron approaches the electron. It slows down. The two of them orbit one another. They throw off their two packets of energy that originally came from that photon, and then they disappear.
Hmm.
Now,
what happens to those?
I'll tell you what happens to them.
Yeah.
If you want to rush me ahead,
No, that'll be fine.
No, that'll be fine. It's okay. They go back to what they were when the photon hit them.
Hmm.
It's a standing wave. Standing wave is a full electromagnetic wave that's negative and positive.
Mm-hmm.
Only the positive is inside the negative. know, they talk about magnets. What happens if you wrap one end of a magnet inside of another?
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that.
Right.
Well, you know what? I can. I can do it with every atom in the universe. I wrap the positive end inside the electrons. That's a standing wave, only it's a little bit more matter-oriented. Now, let's just say I have a standing wave, and all it is a positron and electron. The electron is wrapped around the positron. The positron is in the center. Why did this happen? And where are they? Well, you know what? They're everywhere. Why can't we identify them? We can't identify them because their electromagnetic energy faces each other inside. It's like a little ball with energy bouncing back and forth, you know, like those electric balls, you know, mm-hmm. we have a little thing in the center and
sure.
it goes out to the edge. Well, think of that outside as being an electron. Okay, think of the inside, the middle, as a point particle,
mm-hmm.
which is a positron.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as long as it stays in there, you'll never identify it. It's the water of the universe. They're everywhere.
So this is the ether or something that is made.
It's the ancient ether.
Mm-hmm.
Call it dark matter, call it prime matter, call it pre-matter, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
Doesn't matter. It's everywhere.
And this is where matter comes from?
Well, it comes from energy, E equals mc squared, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I think Einstein was a little bit off. It needs also a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Every bit of matter has a magnetic field, has a half a magnetic field. And the way you get a half a magnetic field is what you do is you take that piece of energy and you fire it, and it goes through the shell of the electron and hits that point particle in the middle and pops it out. And that electron will flip inside out, and the field between the two of them, which just went in and out, now extends like a regular electromagnetic field with a north end and a south end, or a positive end and a negative end.
Wow.
It pops the center out like a, I don't know how to describe it, a cotton bowl.
Mm.
Pops the center out, and that becomes the positron. The shell flips inside out, and it becomes the electron. And now you have a regular electromagnetic field between the two of them. And you have a positron electron, and you have what seems, and you've added the energy of the photon, the high energy photon that hit them, that hit that center particle, you've added it to both particles. So now you have a half of an electromagnetic field with energy. That's an electron, and that's a positron.
Very interesting.
Okay, now, here's the interesting. All of that's very interesting, and nobody will believe it, and blah, 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 I don't care. You know, I can't be bothered. We just have to move on. So let's say you have this, okay, you got a positron. Positron wants to find an electron and annihilate it.
Okay.
You can do that for a long time in a universe that's only got these things, just keeps popping them and destroying them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not destroying them. They just go back to
the original form.
The original form.
Mm-hmm.
Little ball of energy. How did it happen? You can ask me another time. And I can tell you, I think, but I don't know for sure. Okay, now you have that positron. Well, the thing about that positron is that it will attract other things. It will certainly attract electrons. We already know that. Okay. What else will it attract? Well, excuse me, we've got a simple universe. We haven't got many things to attract. In fact, all we have are other prime matter particles. Now, let's see. What do they look like? I think we talked about it a minute ago. They're electrons on the outside and positrons on the inside.
Right.
That means they're negative on the outside and positive on the inside. An electron will not attract them because there's an electron on the outside. The electron will not attract them because there's an electron on the outside.
Yeah, I'm with you.
The positron will attract them, but it will not annihilate with them because there's a positron on the inside, and it will be held at a distance, but it will still attract them.
Hmm.
Okay, now you got a pencil and paper? You don't have a pencil and paper.
I do, trust me.
Okay. It's going to attract five layers. That's 10 by 10 by 10. A square. The field of that positron will cut off at a certain distance, okay, because fields cut off,
mm-hmm.
Positive, negative, in atoms, the field cuts off, okay? It cuts off so the 10 particles, so you got now a square, 10 by 10 by 10, of prime matter particles, one of the ones on the inside, okay, is a positron? Is the positron holding those layers onto it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really 10 by 10 by 10 minus 1.
Okay,
1,000 minus 1, 999.
Right.
The field ends. So each one of the corners, each one of the eight corners, loses 10 particles. It's a nice, even, geometrical loss to make it more rounded. Okay, loses 10. So that's 8 by 10, and subtract that. So now you've subtracted 80.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So now, instead of having 1,000 or 999, you have not 920, but 919.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 919.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have 919 particles, okay, but those are full particles, electrons and positrons. Electron weight is how you measure your atoms, okay, your protons and your neutrons. So electron weight is one electron, so that's one positron, one electron is two. Therefore, your 919 is double that, which is 1,838. Okay?
Yeah.
1,838 just coincidentally happens to be the size of a proton.
In what unit of measure?
Electron weight.
Okay.
Any physicist will tell you that.
All right, all right.
That is how big a proton is.
Remarkable.
Very, very big.
All right.
Now, if you were to add the electron that it will attract, now when that proton, of course, attracts an electron, it becomes a hydrogen atom. And excuse me, with a hydrogen atom, I can make a universe. I'll tell you something else. Scientists have already done this in the laboratory, but a neutron and a proton will attract, they can exchange an electron back and forth from a neutron to a proton. When you take the electron to the proton, it becomes a neutron. When you take it away, it becomes a proton. So a proton and a neutron are the same according to where the electron is.
Okay.
So you not only have an electron, you now have a proton, and you now have a neutron by adding the electron. You're building the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, mm-hmm. There are other methods that have to happen. We have to bring electromagnetic energy into it, and we have to use it in certain ways, which it will take me a couple of hours to explain. But I could be wrong about this, okay? But I say this. There are prime matter particles that are probably made by the spin of the universe, that are essentially you've taken the nothing of the universe, whatever the hell it is, and stretched it out and made these tiny bubbles. And these tiny bubbles can't be very big because Planck tells us you can't make a thing very big. It has to be a given size. So these bubbles can't be very big, so there has to be a shitload of them, and they must be everywhere,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they're all the same. They are electrons on the outside, positrons on the inside. The positron on the inside is trying to pull the universe back together again. The electron on the outside is being pulled by the universe to expand.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as the universe keeps spinning, they will all hold. So you'll have all these bubbles to knock the insides out of and make matter with. And when you do that, and if you go through the process that I'm talking about, and of course you cannot take positrons, you know, in your living room and make protons out of them because they'll find an electron and seemingly annihilate. But there will be places that they will do this. One of those places would be in the outer core of the interior of the Earth, in Earth's electromagnetic field. Because in an electromagnetic field, you can separate electrons from positrons
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
on field lines. Which, in fact, they do in those colliders. How do you preserve a positron in a collider so you can crash it into an electron? You use electromagnetic energy, and you make it ride that field line. And you can keep it spinning around that collider for as long as you want, until you want to crash it into an electron. So we know that. So you can preserve them. So you have to find a place in the universe where there's a field that has electromagnetic field lines, like the Van Allen belts, that will preserve positrons so they can grow into protons. Well, there's one place is inside the Earth, if in fact it's a plasma core and it carries the electromagnetic field of the Earth, that's the perfect place for it.
I'll be there.
Inside the Sun, inside Jupiter, inside every planet in the universe, inside every moon.
Hence their growth.
That's right. Hence their growth. They're making matter all the time. In fact, that is their only purpose. there's only reason to exist is to make more. Understand what I'm saying? They have no other function. Sort of like everything else we know, you know, bacteria, human beings, trees, whatever. It, the matrix was set in the creation of the universe. The reason we have so much matter is making matter all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It has no other function. You have matter floating in the universe, you have hydrogen atoms, can't do anything. So they gather and they gather until they make something big enough that it has, like an egg, you can't call it an egg, but it has a functionality where you're building up heat, you're creating more energy, you're creating more pair production, you're using an electromagnetic field to separate them and to keep them separated until the positron becomes protons, and then you're making hydrogen atoms, and then from the hydrogen atoms you're processing them on electromagnetic lines up until higher count atoms, and then you're making it more and more and more, and you're growing it. The electromagnetic lines around the sun, okay, are like Van Allen belt lines. There are Van Allen belt lines around the sun. No, that can't be, because we haven't discovered them. Well, that's too bad. We haven't discovered them. Let me see. Earth has Van Allen belt lines, and it's got a small magnetic field, and the sun doesn't have electromagnetic lines, doesn't have Van Allen belts. Of course it does. And on those Van Allen belt lines, what the sun does is it takes hydrogen and helium atoms, ionizes them by blasting off the electrons, throws out the nuclei and the electrons into its own system, where the Van Allen belts will pick them up, ride them up and down on electromagnetic lines. Electromagnetic lines closer to the sun, because they're closer, are stronger, and you can fool ions into joining. Why? Because the electromagnetic line that an ion rides on, okay, because an ion is positive, both of, say, two of them, will ride a negative electromagnetic line, which will convince those little ions that they can be drawn together, because the negative line overpowers them and allows them to join into higher count atoms.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have higher count atoms closer to the sun and lower count atoms further away from the sun? Because the electromagnetic lines, the Van Allen belt lines closer to the sun, are stronger, and they can link more nuclei together before they fall off the lines.
Hey, Neil.
Yep.
Let me ask you something.
I messed up your head, haven't I?
Not at all. It's awesome, actually. And there's something that's sort of come up that's related, and I want to read it to you real quick and get your thoughts. This little piece came up in New Scientist maybe just a week and a half or so ago. But anyway, let me read this to you. The common view that nerves transmit impulses through electricity is wrong, and they really transmit sound, according to a new a report from a team of Danish scientists. And
I don't think there's a big difference between the two.
What? In other words, they're all electromagnetic.
I think, yeah, I think sound has got to have an electromagnetic component.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't see how that's possible. I don't think anything doesn't have an electromagnetic component. I think that's the structure of the universe. I mean, you know, you've got a simple universe. You're not going to have a lot of stuff. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got, think about this. So far what I've described to you is you have a prime matter particle that's made by the spin of the universe out of nothing. Okay? You've just made a bubble. Okay? You pop those bubbles into its two constituent halves, and because they're halves, they have a need. Okay? Originally, as a bubble, it didn't have a need. It has no need. It's all fine and complete. So you pop them out. Now they have a need, each for the other. If you can create a structure that stops them from joining, like a proton,
mm-hmm.
because it's buffered by all these particles around it, it won't annihilate the electron. Okay? By the way, in positive beta decay, out of a proton comes a positron. Where did it come from? Wasn't in there all along, was it? Yes, it was. So what you've done is you've made a universe by keeping these particles apart, keeping these two half particles apart. Essentially, you're taking the next step from electron, proton, and neutron. You're saying, okay, it's a simpler universe. All you have is prime matter particles, pop them in half, and you have a negative particle and a positive particle, and the energy that is between them, that wants to pull them together because the universe has pulled them apart, is what we call electromagnetic energy. That's all you have. There are no quarks. There are no muons. There are no gravitons. There are no separate fields. There's only one field. You just have to examine it, and you will, and it will become everything.
Mm.
It's like evolution. It's the evolution of the universe. Starts basically simple with nothing. That nothing becomes gets pulled apart and becomes essentially bubbles in the universe. They're broken in half, two halves that are the opposite of one another, and a field between them. And that's all. That's all.
I'll be damned. All right, look, we've got 10 minutes. And I want to ask you how the hell this stuff relates to what is happening on planet Earth. You're a smart guy and an interesting guy, and I'm believe it or not, I want to know what your take on the news of the day is and what's happening on this planet in a general sense and where it's all going.
When I was a kid, everybody that I knew smoked. And they tried to convince me to smoke. And in my mind, my imagination, I thought, if I stick my face next to a burning building and inhale the smoke, that's what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And it's stupid. Okay? And when I got a little bit older, people would drink their lunch. And they invited me to drink my lunch. And I had to discover a White Russian in order to have something because it tasted like a cup of coffee. But I only had that like once a month. So I don't drink. I don't smoke,
mm-hmm.
and I've discovered that nowadays people drink water for lunch, and they don't smoke anymore. Those poor, suffering characters outside of the buildings that are smoking in front of the buildings are the only ones that are left that smoke. And we're into preventive medicine, and we're into health, and I go to the gym once a week. I'm 65 years old, and I can bench press 300 pounds. I can leg press over 1,000 pounds.
Holy cow.
Okay? Most of my hair is brown and thick. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as individuals and as a community and as a country, we had better spend our time doing positive things for ourselves, for our neighbors, and for the world. And that's the way we have a good world.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to worry about greenhouse gases, and we don't have to worry about saving the North Pole and the South Pole. What we have to worry about is saving our own backyards.
Right.
We have to get into hydrogen power. Hydrogen power will run our automobiles. If there will be plane crashes, those plane crashes will happen without fire. Hydrogen power and on all the other things that are due in our future will make our lives better. It's already made our lives better in my lifetime just by stopping smoking and drinking,
mm-hmm.
and people being arrested for drunk driving. I when I was a kid, they started to take my comic books away. And people work really hard to undo that. We're looking for a future that is very, very positive and very, very wonderful, and we all have to work at it. And if we don't work at it, and we're stupid, and you know we do have a tendency to be stupid, and if we're stupid, we won't have all those wonderful things, and we won't have the wonderful world that I think we deserve. But if we are smart, just a little bit, not real strong smart, we take care of things, and we take care of ourselves and our families, and we work hard, but we don't work so hard that we ignore our families and we ignore our health. Those three things, health, family, and work. That's what a man and a woman need.
Mm-hmm.
Health, not too much, family, and work. Balanced. If you don't have the other two, then the other one doesn't work, the one that's left. If you do those things, you'll have a great and wonderful life. And I think that we have an opportunity in this world to do that. And so I look forward to the future with my kids and my grandkids and a better world scientifically, a better world to live in. You know, when I was a kid, I used to watch newsreels that told me about California and how they would film the smog.
Mm-hmm.
It was covered with smog. You couldn't even see the city.
Right.
I have a house there, and I never see smog.
Amazing.
They've taken care of it. If we apply ourselves to our problems, we'll take care of them.
How,
we can't panic and run out in the street and carry on, and we can't bitch and carry on. We have to just knuckle down and do the work.
Neil, how do you think, or how profound are some of the implications of your work with regard to some of these
scientifically?
Things? Scientifically? Yeah, with regard to energy and all this sort of thing.
Every textbook on Earth will be rewritten.
So it's another one of these paradigm shifters.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm amazed that I'm even part of it. I'm just totally shocked. Some days I can't deal with it. I try to disprove it just so I could get out from under the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that it's no different than anything else. Early on in comic books, when I was fighting against the things that I was fighting against, people would say, you're crazy, you're an idiot, what are you doing? Nobody agreed with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I didn't care if they agreed with me.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing was to work on your percentages, get good percentages. I believe in getting good percentages. Work on percentages. Increase that percentage. Get past 50%. Don't ever expect 100%, and you'll be doing fine.
Right.
And make things better all the time.
How are the comic books relaying these messages?
Well, we try to be very positive. I'm doing a series on Batman, and I'm going to have Batman kind of rediscover himself.
Maybe he discovers a magic mushroom somewhere or something.
You know, having a positive life doesn't mean that you have to suffer to have it. Having a positive life is the happiest thing you could ever do. It brings joy and happiness all the time.
Mm.
You know, I walk around with a smile on my face all the time.
Mm.
Why? Because I'm happy, because I'm working at all these positive things.
Right.
And I try to bring other people along with me. And I know there are people everywhere that are like me. I'm not alone. I'm not just like, you know, some suffering individual.
Right. That's true.
There's a whole lot of happy people.
Hey, there's a whole lot of people
everywhere.
Listening to this show right now that
exactly.
are totally digging what you're talking
you turn
about.
Turn around and you'll meet a happy person. You see that? What have you got that smile on your face? I don't know. It feels good.
Yeah.
I don't understand that people don't work for a positive future. We have a group, Expanding Earth group, and I guess in the last year it's increased about 100-fold. And every once in a while somebody starts whining about the hole in the ozone and all the rest of it.
Mm.
And I think that's fine, you know, if you believe that. But don't whine about it.
Mm.
You know, go and join an organization, take care of your home, you know, use solar panels, whatever it is that you can do, become an example to the rest of the community. And if you do that, then you will have an influence. And you don't have to change the world overnight. You just have to be part of a positive change.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people will join.
Right, right.
That's how things get done.
All right. What do you got coming up? What do you got going in the future here?
Oh, what have I got? Well, you know, I got the book that I'm working on. But what I'm trying to turn the Internet into a kind of publishing. If you go to YouTube, what you'll see is that one of the videos that I have up there has 140,000 visitors.
Right.
Now I know that the cat farting video has 3 million, and I know I can't compete with that. And the Oriental breast massage, I'm not going to get anywhere near. But 140,000.
Yeah, it's no stink of the eye.
Right. But 140,000 is a lot of people.
It is.
And it seems to be going up exponentially.
Mm.
Now, and some of them, every once in a while, I'll get a scientist, I'll get a physicist or a geologist.
Right.
Now, I've been told they're not going to drop in. They're not going to say anything. But, you know, they get curious and they want to know stuff. And they're willing to learn. I'm not the kind of person that takes kindly to folks giving me a really hard time. I mean, it's not what you do. You know, you be nice, and if you're not nice, you know, I'll cut you. Because it's just not what you want to do.
Mm.
So I'm not going to suffer the same fate that Carrie's going to suffer unless I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, then I deserve what the heck I get. But I just don't see it.
Right.
So I'm taking a very positive attitude toward this, and I'm using the Internet as, in effect, a publishing dissemination of information and discussion. And I think it's, I don't know, maybe the first time it's ever been done.
It's amazing. You know, I had sort of a note here to ask you in general what you make of, you know, the technology and our ability to share information these days.
Well, think about this. If I do a book, well, first of all, if I do a book and I publish it, I'll get to the comic book folks. If I do a regular book through a regular publisher, and there's a publisher, there's a couple of publishers that are interested, one in particular, I'll sell the book. You know, I'll take a period of time, and it'll sell. It'll hit the bestseller list only if they sell 10,000 copies, and that's not a lot of copies. And how many physicists are going to get to read it? I don't know. Maybe some will. But if I go on the Internet, within a couple of months, I've got 140,000 people that have watched the video.
Mm-hmm.
Or one of the videos, and watch. Some of them have watched the other videos. Some of them come to my site. Some of them read the physics, and some of them call, you know, write me notes and give me a hard time. And that's going to keep on happening. And something's going to happen from it. I don't know what's going to happen. If you think you have a solid plan, the idea is to follow through with a plan, and don't assume that something good is going to happen. Just go with it. My mom told me when I was a kid, she said, you know, if you're doing something good for somebody and you think it's a good thing and you expect somebody to come around later and thank you for it, you ought not start it. You know, you just do it because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
So, you know, I still have my career. I have other things. I'm probably going to do a book on religion that'll get me shot when I'm 80 years old. And I'm having a good time doing it all.
Oh, man.
You see on my site, if you don't look at the science stuff, you see we do computer animation.
Yeah, you see
I do comic books.
Right,
people seem to like it. I'm having a very good time of doing the series of Batman things. It'll probably get a whole lot more attention than this science thing.
Right. Well,
except in the end, this will change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Or not.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter. You know, mm-hmm. It may sound like it, but I really don't have my ego invested in it.
Right.
I took it as a job. I thought, nobody else is going to do this. I got to do it, because clearly Carrie is right. And the other thing, too, is everything about these videos, believe me, it's an extension of Sam Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
It's none of mine. My stuff is the physics stuff,
right.
Which is, I mean, it's going to be a harder sell. But Sam Carrie is the guy who did it.
I'll tell you what. I talk to lots and lots of people and in lots of different fields of endeavor, and one of the main things that I always look for is people that, you know, recognize their ancestors and the people on whose shoulders they stand, you know, and you do that, Neil, and I don't care how you present it. You're doing great work, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you sharing it with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, it has been awesome, and I hope we can do it again. There's a whole lot more to talk about.
Sure, anytime.
All right, well, you know, it's 3 a.m. in New York City, and you've been an absolute gentleman, and I can't tell you, again, how much I appreciate it. We'll do it again, and thanks, and we'll make sure that more people get a chance to familiarize themselves with this stuff, okay?
Okay, and if anybody gets mad and starts to get all upset, you just tell them, hey, you can take a joke.
I will do it. Neil, take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
All right, cheers. Everybody, wonderful stuff. Neil Adams on the web at neiladams, NEALADAMS.com. And you'll be able to link over there from my site from here on out. We'll have this show up in the archives real soon. And thanks, everybody, for participating in the program. It's been absolutely wonderful. And Neil, again, one more time, thanks very much. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. We'll be back with you next week. I've got Peter Light. We'll be talking about permaculture, sustainable communities, and lots of good stuff about things that grow. Okay, we'll come back. We'll do it. I'm not sure about music. I'll come up with something good for you. Thanks again to Lizzie and Baba for coming down tonight, and for everybody for hanging out and listening. Been a great time, as always. We'll come back and do it again next week. One more time for Neil Adams on the web at neiladams.com. Wonderful stuff, and I appreciate the time we had to spend with him. Okay, let's see. We'll finish things off with Looking for Leonard Cohen. Part 1. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. Thanks again, everyone. Take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you next week.
Looking for Leonard Cohen, Part 1.
Maybe they fought last night, but they're together now. Maybe they're not that nice. They'll be nice now. I remember the position that I was once in, and I wish I could be there now. Oh, how I wish I could be there now. I went and locked the fences. I went went and hid the wine. Still you worked your way through the fences. You went and took the wine. You took the wine. You didn't see me sitting by the cases. The garden grin and smoking hands. My tan pants and my polished helmet. This crumpled map of all my plans. I remember the position I was once in. I wish I could be there now. Oh, how I wish I could be there now. At the last Leonard Cohen in the morning on South Tremaine. If the dog is just a metaphor, and Whitman, is he just a frame? Is he just a frame? Which way from here? Which way from here? Oh, poor, poor Danny. That's not the way hold a gun. Switching feet to make you see me. I scratch my face before I run. Then I feel all of the bleeding, and I think you must be right behind. But if you saw me go, then you must have followed. I forgot the fence and I left the wine. And I wish I could be there now. Oh God, I wish I could be there now.